You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 42. Today is a good day to die. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the winner of IDW's Red Shirt Contest, Star Trek Ongoing number 7, Sir Patrick Stewart at the Peabody Awards, Leonard Nimoy on The Big Bang Theory, and some movie news and rumors. Then in the feature, we're joined by Larry Nemechek as we discuss the TNG episode, Sins of the Father. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Christopher, I am doing fantastic. It has been the most beautiful weekend in Seattle. And that's this is not me saying, you know, compared to how Seattle usually is, it's beautiful. You know, there's like a speck of blue in the sky. No. It is amazing this weekend. And I'm sure the moment I say this, the good weather will be canceled by sci-fi. But I'm very excited right now because it was warm and sunny and pleasant. For 2 days. It was Friday and Saturday. So I just had the best weekend ever.
You're right. We should be glad sci-fi does not have control over every aspect of life, right?
Not yet. I know sci-fi has control over Vancouver, Canada, like complete creative control. Hopefully that won't bleed into Seattle this weekend.
I just see those people in Vancouver. It's like, oh, we're so glad we're getting an extra trash day on Thursday every week now. And then you get a memo from sci-fi. Sorry, extra trash day has been canceled.
Yes.
Just leave all of your trash in front of the Netflix office.
Right. But as a bonus, Felicia Day does appear in Vancouver, you know, every 6 months or so. So, you know, that's a trade-off. That's a trade-off I would go with.
So are your cherry blossoms blooming in Seattle yet?
They've actually been blooming for actually a couple weeks, and they're very nice. They're actually starting to go away. I think as Seattle loses its cherry blossoms, they start up in Japan. Is it down in Tokyo? Is it cherry blossom season?
We got a little ways to go. Maybe another 2 weeks. It's been kind of cool here in the spring so far. So the buds are coming out, but I think we're going to have a slight delay, maybe like first week of April. But like you said, the first thing about it, you know, people picture Japan and they picture all of the cherry blossoms everywhere and they're so beautiful. But man, when those things bloom, they last a few days and then they're gone. So
you got to take a lot of pictures, upload them all to Twitter. That's very important.
A steady stream.
Have at least 5 picnics underneath them in the 3 days that they're there.
Yes. But when I go to those picnics, which of course are called Ohanami, in Japanese, one thing that I will not be doing is I will not be wearing my red shirt, Greg. And that actually will lead us into our first news story today.
Which is about the cherry blossom alien that hasn't... It is about the IDW's red shirt contest. We talked about this a couple months ago, how if you entered this contest, you and the comic book store owner of your choice could be on the cover of an upcoming Star Trek Ongoing, we should say. Comic from IDW.
Yeah, you know, it's a story that I hadn't forgotten about it, but I had been wondering what was happening with the story because I feel like it kind of fell off the map across all of Star Trek media for a while and wasn't quite sure. I was like, well, have they announced the winner? What's going on? And finally, we do have a winner, and their name is Corey Trim from St. Charles, Missouri. And Corey, his favorite retail store was the Fantasy Shop, owned by Ricardo Montalban and his sidekick, Tattoo. No, sorry, that was Fantasy Island. This was the Fantasy Shop owned by Mike Brodeur.
That's right.
And so both Corey and Mike are going to be on the cover, as you said, of an upcoming ongoing comic.
And hopefully some terrible fate will be befalling them in the course of the cover. You know, hopefully a spear will be going straight through their chest or a piano will be falling on them, something of that nature.
You know, I'm picturing like they're going to do a photo shoot to get the, you know, the pose, and then they're going to illustrate based on the photo or whatever. I'm not sure, but if they're doing a photo shoot, I would request that it be shot in a very open area. So, you know, I don't want any lights hanging overhead, nothing like that. I would want to make sure that it's an area where no creatures can sneak up. So not near a forest in any way if it's outside in a park. I would just be really, really careful.
Chris, I don't know if you could get me in a red shirt, you know, even for a photo shoot. I'd be wary of wearing a TNG red shirt just because of the connotation.
I think I would too. Yes, I would not want to be out there.
What, Chris, I don't know if you own a uniform, but if you did own a Star Trek uniform from any of the series, which series would it be, and which division, which color would you choose?
Oh, man, that's a good question. Now, I did own a uniform once upon a time when I was university age, and it was a Next Generation Command Red, although that was, at that time, your choices were the original series or the Next Generation uniforms.
Right.
There were no jumpsuit pajamas from early DS9 or any of the stuff that came after. So our choices were rather limited. Oh, man, you know, I actually think if I could afford to buy one, I still think the sharpest uniforms are the ones from The Wrath of Khan onwards in the original series movies. So maybe that. I would want to supplement it, though, you know, with like one of those really, really giant honking Admiral belt buckles, though.
I thought you maybe wanted one of those bitchin' necklaces like the one McCoy had in the motion picture.
Well, I definitely need one of those, too. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I would actually make sure that my uniform was modified to be bell-bottom.
Right. Now, I was aiming for, actually, I'm thinking of getting one of those third season next-gen uniforms with the nice little collar and getting it in science blue. You know, I don't even know, I guess Crusher wore that uniform, but there's not, that I can think of, not too many people wore that uniform on the show.
You don't see it a lot, yeah, because the people who would have worn it would, of course, have been Troy, who she, you know, doesn't really wear a uniform until near the end of the series when they finally start putting her in a uniform sometimes.
Now, Chris, she does wear clothes. She just doesn't wear the uniform. Let's be clear.
Yes, yes. That's right. At least when she's on the bridge.
Right.
Now, when she's off duty with Riker, I don't know what's going on down there, but that, of course, is going to be on the future box sets that have all the B-sides,
right.
You know, everything else that was happening on the ship during the episodes that we know and love. Yeah, but you don't see it much. You know, occasionally you have guests come on, like Solar, the Vulcan doctor, you know, she was wearing it, but not much. And even when Crusher wore it, it was kind of that wishy-washy blue, right? Where they wasn't quite the same blue as everyone else.
Yeah, well, and she always had the coat on, and it just wasn't, it never felt like she was really, so I guess I would be a guest star on TNG. That's what we're coming down to. And hopefully I wouldn't get crushed by any falling anvils. How can we see this special cover? It's going to be the normal comic cover. There's going to be Spock, and he's going to be tousling with Mike Broder.
Oh, you mean the one with the issue coming up, Broder's Vengeance? No, apparently this won't be the only cover for that issue. It's a limited edition variant cover. They're going to produce 300 of these, and 100 will be given to Corey Trim, the winner, and the Fantasy Shop. And then another 100 goes to the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, because that was kind of what this whole project was designed for in the first place, was to raise money for the defense fund.
I like the idea that the benefit Comic Legal Defense Fund gets is they get to sell these 100 issues for as much as they can get for them, and then whatever they get back, you know, they can... I think there was some donation going to them as well from IDW, and there's been a lot of public... at least now, they've been talking about them a lot and hopefully getting more people knowledgeable about what the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund actually does.
Yeah. But I think they'll fetch a good price for them, though.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, these will be great, great collector's items.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that they, because obviously you and I are only getting the digital versions, I do hope it's included in there as we swipe through. They usually have all the alternate covers on the iPad server, so hopefully we'll be able to see it there as well.
Yeah, I think it will be. And I should clarify that that Corey Trim gets 100 and also
right.
Mike Brodeur also gets 100. So that's 200 and then 100 goes to the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. And speaking of that, Greg, I don't know if you saw this, but I want to say what I saw was, it wasn't IDW, but Marvel and DC, I believe. I remember you were saying you were going to buy all of your comics on your iPad now that you have the Retina display. I saw last week a story that these publishers are going to start bundling digital copies with their print copies. So if you buy the print one, you get a code, you know, where you can go and download the digital. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, which makes a lot of sense. Which I was actually in a comic shop today. We're going to talk in a moment about part of the reason I was in there. But yeah, it'd be very cool if I could buy the actual version, you know, maybe flip through it once and then put it away and be able to always pull it up on my iPad. But I think aside from that, the main problem with the comic book for me, the physical version, is just getting to the comic book shop because there just aren't enough of them. And that's another thing about this contest was promoting comic book shops, you know, your local comic book shop and how important it is to have some place that's close, that's stocked, that has a friendly person who can help you find whatever you need. Because it's not the friendliest, it's not the easiest thing to get. You know, if I want a toaster, I can go to the Cylon shop and buy a toaster. It's not so easy with comic books sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. You get that. You've got one of those fracking outlets down there near you, right?
Sounds Swedish.
I wonder if, with the digital copies, if Sheldon is really anal retentive about fingerprints getting on the screen as you're viewing the digital comic.
Oh, my roommate is Sheldon because she just got an iPad and she's terrified about these smudges on her screen. I keep telling myself that she'll get over it. You know, in another week she'll be over it. But right now she's like scrubbing it off every 5 seconds.
You get used to it. You don't notice it too much. Well, Greg, while we're talking about comics, we should mention really quickly for everyone who was looking forward to Star Trek Ongoing number 7 coming out this past Wednesday. I don't know exactly what happened, but there was a problem and there was a delay and the comic book did not come out. And our friend Jason Genser on Twitter, who talks to us quite a lot, checked with IDW to find out what was going on because I guess he went to get the comic and it wasn't out. And at first, even who he was talking to at IDW seemed a little bit unsure about what was happening, but they quickly found out that there had been a delay. And very quickly, they also found out that things had been cleared up. And this coming Wednesday, March 28th, Star Trek Ongoing number 7, which is now called Vulcan's Vengeance, part 1, will be out in the store.
Yeah.
And now, Greg, that's a name change from what we were seeing before.
Yeah, well, what was it called before?
It was called the Vengeance Conspiracy.
Right, which was
all the covers. Yeah.
Yeah, the Vulcan Ultimatum. I think the new name is much better. I don't know if I mentioned, Chris, but I did some of my own independent reporting on this. I actually discovered that it was actually the printing press for IDW is on a Romulan moon, and a group of Vulcan terrorists broke into the printing press and set some explosives. And unfortunately, that entire run has been lost, and they've had to move their printing onto the Klingon moon of Praxis, which nothing wrong is going to happen there.
Good idea. Boy, that's a great... I mean, if you're going to move something, Praxis, that's a fantastic place to move your facilities.
They were thinking SETI Alpha 4, but, you know.
Yeah.
One's as good as the other.
Yeah, I also heard that they were considering Viridian 3 at one point.
But then, yes. Anyway, I was really... And we were going to talk about it on the show today. I was very excited, and I didn't know until Wednesday morning. No comic, but again, this is part of the problem with comic books. They get delayed from time to time, and I guess we're just going to have to wait. I hope this doesn't mean that issue 2 is going to be delayed as well.
Hopefully not.
Yeah.
So. It's only a week, so hopefully, you know, when April comes around, they'll release it on the normal schedule.
Yeah.
Yeah. As long as nothing goes wrong on Praxis, anyway.
Right. So if you turned on your iPad app and you tried to go and download it, don't panic. Nothing's wrong with your machine. Nothing's wrong with your anything. Just be patient. And I'm doing my best to be patient.
Okay. So what else do we have up, Greg? We've got a little bit of news about some of our TNG cast, I think.
Yes, we do. We have Sir Patrick Stewart. Many of you may remember played Hamlet in a movie that keeps showing up in my Netflix queue. But I hear he was a Star Trek actor as well, and he's going to be hosting the Peabody Awards this year, which is very, very well-regarded awards that go out to TV shows and all sorts of things. Star Trek seems to always be up for Peabody's.
Yes. I hear he was in Star Trek. I also hear... You know, I heard you call him Sir Patrick Stewart there, and for a minute I wasn't sure what you're talking about. And I guess I also hear that he was knighted, apparently. I don't know if you saw this, Greg, but a StarTrek.com's Facebook page, they ran this story, and you know, they write Sir Patrick Stewart. And one of the first comments was, "Sir Patrick Stewart? I must have missed that one."
Right.
And I was thinking, oh, yeah, you did. And if you read through, there was so many people constantly who had no idea that Patrick Stewart had been knighted by the Queen. But they're big enough Star Trek fans that they're posting on the Facebook page of StarTrek.com.
Right. I mean, at this point, I'm surprised when a British person hasn't been knighted. You've got Sir Patrick Stewart. You've got Sir Elton John. I heard.
Well, don't forget our biggest fan on Twitter, Sir Colin.
Yep, that's exactly right. I heard Colin, our fan Colin, and Chris Martin from Coldplay, you know, they got knighted at the same time. Pretty much everybody, you know, Troy, you know, Deanna Troi sort of has that fake British accent. She got knighted the other day. She's a woman, and she's not even British. And it's still, you know, so...
Yeah. Well, I mean, it goes everywhere. It's kind of unbelievable. My kids were watching TV the other day, and I don't know if you, have you seen this show? It's been around for quite a long time. It's a Sir Thomas the Tank Engine.
Right. The Sir Teletubbies is on right before that.
That's right. So anyway, Sir Patrick Stewart, who was knighted by the Queen with a batleth, which was apparently ordered from the computer by Jadzia Dax, because it needed to be really fancy, you know, for the ceremony. He is going to be hosting the Peabody Awards on Monday, May 21st, and that will be in New York City.
Yes, so we can look forward to them. I don't know if they're airing on television. I don't know if we'll actually be able to see this anywhere, but I'm sure we'll hear reports and such. And I'm definitely looking forward to see who wins some Peabody's this year and, you know, see one of those TNG actors. Now, I heard there's going to be another Star Trek actor in some place unexpected this year.
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, not only this year, but this week, Leonard Nimoy is going to be appearing on The Big Bang Theory in an episode called The Transporter Malfunction. Now, Greg, is this going to be... is it going to be like Spige, or are we going to have Spelden on here? What exactly is going on here?
Live long and sign the roommate agreement.
Exactly. So I don't know what the story is. And to be honest with you, I don't personally want to know much about this because at the rate that Super Channel, which is the channel that shows Big Bang Theory here in Japan, at the rate that they are releasing the Big Bang Theory, I probably won't get to see this episode until maybe like 2016.
Right.
So,
yeah, I mean, another story is that it was just announced that Will Wheaton is going to be on the show again. Have you even seen Will Wheaton on The Big Bang Theory yet?
Once. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, right. We finally got to the first episode that featured Will Wheaton. And I love the t-shirts, the Wesley Crushers.
Yes. Yes. I do. Oh, man. I love Will Wheaton on the show. I can't wait to see Nimoy. I'm a little perturbed, though. Apparently, we talked about Leonard Nimoy's retirement on the show, and so Sci-Fi canceled it.
Exactly. I thought something was going on here. I did think he was supposed to be retired. Apparently, Sci-Fi does have power over all of our lives.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Okay, well, so everyone watch for that. That's coming on this Thursday, as I understand the schedule in the U.S., March 29th, and the transporter malfunction. Okay, Greg, well, moving on to our next story, what do we have up next?
Chris, well, we've got that story about the 105th annual re-recreation of the Great Triple Hunt in Kronosville, a little town in Georgia that's decided to declare itself the Klingon capital of America.
Larry?
Oh.
Larry, where's Greg?
Hi, Chris. It's me. It's okay. No,
Larry,
no,
what
it's
are you
okay.
doing
He
here?
okay. So he's like in the broom closet in the transporter room. Okay, is that okay? I just wanted to say hi tonight.
Well, welcome. Welcome to the ready room. So,
He'll be fine. He'll be fine. He's such a Mr. Adventure, you know. So I well, thanks.
well, I'm glad you stopped by anyway, Larry, because actually, I've been wanting to talk to you about these tours that you're doing with
Oh,
Geek
you heard
Nation
about that,
Tours. So
did you?
this seems like as good a time as any.
Well,
Yeah. So what's going
imagine
on with
that,
that?
because I just happen to have in my other broom closet of the transporter room. Wait, but he's not coming out of the closet, so to speak. I'm sorry. So, Terrace Cassidy, who has Geek Nation Tours.
What a great intro. Thank you very much. That was awesome.
Yeah, welcome. Welcome to the Ready Room,
Thank you,
Terrace.
Chris.
All right. Why don't you guys tell us about these tours that you've got going? This sounds pretty interesting.
Well, we're headed off to various filming sites before we head off to the Las Vegas Con. Larry and I have talked over the last year about getting together and doing something together to see some cool sites, see some filming sites for Star Trek, and then also head off to the Las Vegas convention.
Being August, we'll probably see some hot sites too.
That's right. Yeah, so we get to see various locations in the LA area, and we're going to be bussing it all the way through the mountains of California and through Death Valley, and then all the way to Vegas. And we're going to be stopping and seeing some ultra cruel sights. Larry, you
Yeah.
want to jump in there?
Or UCS, as we call them in the industry. Yeah. No, Terrace came up to me last year at the Vegas convention and said, "I do Geek Nation tours. I have a travel agency, but I've done this on the side for 3 or 4 years." And he does. They've done military site tours, gaming conventions. They've done a castle tour in Scotland and in Germany, and he's done Civil War sites. And he said, "I'd like to do a Star Trek filming site tour. Would you like to do it?" Which is great because I'm doing research on that for a project and have all the research and interviewing and contacts there. So the hard part was taking the full known list of sites and whittling it down to something as a startup to do, and then maybe do a bigger one next year. And we decided to start it up by attaching it to the front end of the Vegas convention. So basically, people would fly into LA. We have about 4 or 5 days in LA and then on the road, and then we wind up in Vegas in time to go to the Vegas convention. And the package is also, now I'm sounding like the travel guy, but your package is also the hotel there at the Rio. And you're of course going to the convention, but Terrace is around to help people with nighttime events or if they need anything. And then there's a goodbye Sunday night, Monday morning, whatever. And you leave from Las Vegas. And for some reason, he thought I would be able to add some added value to the time in LA. So we came up with the plan, and we're going to go to some famous places and some places that are pretty obscure, and a lot of it overlaid that it's a good place to be in Hollywood and LA, even if you're not a Trek fan, but the fact that it's got Trek connections. So places like, Vasquez Rocks and Santa Monica Pier and the Observatory, but also some pretty obscure places too. So it'll be a wacky time with a lot of people from around the world, all fellow fans.
So one of those obscure places is that the broom closet where you've
I
apparently
know, I'm
left
so
Greg
mad
for
that I gave it
the
away. That was when we were gonna like release the
seventh
week before and tease it all the way until
Yeah.
then.
Now, Larry, you said 4 or 5 days in LA. Now, are you telling me that people have to spend 4 or 5 days with you?
Some would consider that a great honor, Chris. But no, I won't. Even if I do shower and use deodorant, I won't stay 24/7. No, I'll be there every day, and a couple of days we'll be together. But there, you're staying at a hotel in Hollywood, and we have an in-town segment, and then we go further afield. And then Tuesday morning, we lit out on the bus, as we would say down south, and go up to Lone Pine and stop through for places along the way. And cool
Okay.
ones, and we and very, this is very cool because we spent a lot of time figuring out what would work, not just where are the places to go to, but what works as a tour schedule, where can you get a busload of people into. And but one of the things, when we go to Vasquez Rocks, we'll have Bobby Clark come out and talk to everybody, who was Mr. Gorn, who you can see.
Now, is he going to come out in the Gorn outfit, or is he just going to
No,
come out in
and
suits?
that'd be awful hot.
Larry's going to wear the Gorin outfit, actually.
For the whole tour.
Everybody's not going to know if it's him or not because he's wearing the mask all through the tour, too, actually. So.
Now, you guys are just being silly. No, I won't wear the outfit. Bobby is going to wear it in a holographic version because that'd be way too hot in August. So.
Right.
No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
But. So basically here, though, you're in L.A. four or five days, and you're using it as a base. When you're not in the city itself, you're going out on different days. Is Tuesday the only day that you take a bus tour out?
No. We come in on Saturday, and I don't want to jump all over Terrace. They arrive on Saturday. We have a hello dinner greeting area. Then Saturday night, we hit the observatory. And then Sunday, we get up, hit the bus, and we're going we have four or five places to go through the day. And then come back at night. And then Monday, we're going to go to the studio, we're going to go to Grauman's Chinese, go to Bronson Canyon, home of 1,000 planets. A couple more things have slipped my mind. And then rest up. And then Tuesday, we take out of town for Vasquez. And we go to the Q Continuum on Tuesday, which is one of the more obscure places I was talking about. And wound up on Shaka Rih and everything from seeing where Kirk's cabin is, or will be, or was, to one of the Voyager film sites, and all up around Lone Pine, there's three or four different Trek sites. And then Wednesday, we hit the bus, go through Death Valley, because it's there. It's not a Trek film site, it's the only thing, but how can you go through Death Valley and not stop? And we have an air-conditioned bus, so we don't anticipate any casualties and from the heat stroke. And then we get to Vegas.
Yeah, and what's great about it is that we get to kind of insert ourselves in a lot of these places that we've seen. Like on Sunday, the day after we go out to the observatory, we go into Tillman's, which of course is where they do the HQ, Starfleet HQ. And it's going to be awesome because every time I see the pictures that Larry has sent me, it's just like, wow, I get to go there. Like, you always think it's an artist rendition, right? So it's going to be a lot of fun. And whenever we get a group together on one of my tours, everybody has common vocabulary, everybody talks the same talk, and everybody loves the same geeky thing. And what's great about it is that you have grow instant friendships and camaraderie. And by the time you're in Vegas, it's going to really help your experience of Vegas too, because it can be kind of overwhelming. It's rather large, and if you've got a group of people to chum with, it's going to be a lot of fun too. So I think it meshes well with the Las Vegas convention for sure.
Yeah, I had to get to know Terrace from August and know that he was, you know, a grounded guy, had a real business. This was going to be a fly by night thing. And when I realized that he marketed around the world, he has Australians and Japanese and other Asians and Canadians and Americans and UK and Germany and Germans and all around Europe. And I realized that a lot of them, this is a great thing because if they're getting up their nerve to come to Vegas alone or even with a buddy, it's a great way to bond and have some friends. And at the same time, you're meeting not just people, but fans, because, you know, fans are people too.
Fans are people too.
You're meeting fan people.
So I hear.
That's the rumor. You're meeting them from all over the world, which is really cool. And, you know, if you've been to L.A., even if you've seen one or two of these places on your own, I mean, like the Tillman Plant or Vasquez Rocks are out there. You can go. But seeing them in a group would be cool. And, of course, at Vasquez, having Bobby there will be – that's a one-of-a-kind thing. No one's ever done that before. So it's really something, you know, if you're experienced or veteran, if you're domestic or you're international, but still within the sound of our voice. It really sounded exciting to me the way he's got it structured. So I was really happy to jump in and lead the charge.
Yeah, and Larry's, of course, an integral part of this because he gets to show us where all the intricacies were. And especially, like, for instance, we go to Paramount Studios. And he's going to show us all the details. You know, we'll have the regular touristy tour, but we'll also have him pointing to, you know, that particular stairway, this happened, or in that corner, this happened. And so we will have a really different perspective as well as a kind of a touristy perspective. So not only will you get your Trek on, your geek on, but you'll also be a tourist. So it'll be a lot of fun on a whole bunch of different levels.
But, and the other thing he won't say is, but Terrace has all of his tours are set up. So if you've got the spouse or significant other that's not the biggest fan in the world or whatever, he'll set it up for something for them to do if they don't want to go along or, you know, be totally bored, whatever. If they're getting to Vegas to go game all day while you're running around your uniform or T-shirt or whatever appropriately, then there's something for them to do even on the tour end too. So,
yeah.
So if you're running around in your uniform and they don't want to be seen with you.
That's right. My solution is normally hold her hand very hard.
What is it you call the program for them? You call the alternate reality?
Yeah, the parallel universes.
Parallel universe, yeah.
Parallel universes for non-geek spouses.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, that we take care of them too.
This all sounds really exciting. Now, Terrace, if anyone wants to join the tour, tell them how to find you, how to sign up, and, you know, what other details.
Sure, just go to geeknationtours.com, and there you can go to upcoming tours to see the full tour description, and hit the booking tab to book and send us your information. We don't have a credit card form there. We like to talk to our clients as soon as face-to-face or voice-to-voice, so we usually call them right after they send us their booking information. Or you can contact me at headgeek@geeknationtours if you have any questions at all.
And again, the dates for these tours are?
The dates are?
The Saturday before Vegas.
The Saturday before Vegas, August 4th. That's very funny. August 4th to the 13th. You caught me
Which
there.
Does encompass, which actually, you know, we say through Vegas, but it's, I mean, to Vegas, but it also, you Includes technically Vegas. Go through the Monday after.
Well, it sounds great. So I hope some of our listeners are going to join you there on the tours and hang out with Larry. And maybe one of them will be brave enough to step up when you get to Vasquez Rocks for the Fight Bobby event.
You're spreading those rumors already, yeah. Well, the only fight we don't want is the other thing is there's only one bus. It's only 35 max seats, so people need to jump in sooner than later. But Terrace is taking deposits, so... That's the other thing we were trying to emphasize to people, to jump in, you know, quick.
All right. Well, Larry, in case Greg wants to jump in, could you go let him out of the broom closet there for me so we can continue on with the show?
You know what? I've got one of those little twinkly sounding things like Kirk put up on the tribbles, you know, the cargo bay doors, the storage compartments, yeah. You know. So I'll go use that and let him out, I guess.
All right. Just make sure he doesn't fall on your head.
As long as the Greg doesn't fall on my head.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Larry, and thanks a lot, Terrace.
Thanks for letting us barge in.
Thank you.
Oh, Greg. Hey, you're back. Well, I'm glad you're back. Now, what was going on? Did Larry actually lock you in a broom closet?
I honestly got into a conversation with one of the brooms. He's a really fascinating guy. He's from Anaheim, and we're talking about, I mean, we're both big Weezer fans, and honestly, the time just flew by.
Well, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I was a little bit worried. You know, Larry kept going on and on about Vasquez Rocks and places like that, and I was afraid that he was going to feed you to the Gorn. So I'm glad that the worst that happened was that you got stuck in a closet for 15 minutes and you got to make friends with a new broom. I think that's a ready room first, in fact.
Yeah, well, these things are set to happen. So, I mean, did I miss anything in the news? Did I miss any of the news stories?
Oh, no, just something about some tours that they're taking.
Okay. I'm all right. I'll just have to go back and listen to the show after we air it.
You get to pay some money and then you have to spend like 3 or 4 or 5 days with Larry. So that's something like that.
I'm spending, you know, a couple hours with Larry this weekend at Emerald City Comic Con. So that should be plenty, honestly.
You'll have your own tour. All right. Well, Greg, let's move on here. Now, I was searching this was very interesting. I was searching the other day for an image. I think it was when I was doing our motion picture stuff, and I came across a vintage poster from 1989 for Star Trek V. And I thought I knew all the posters, and apparently this is a real poster. I'm not making this up. This was a real poster, and it's got a picture of a theater seat floating in space, and there's a seatbelt on the seat, and it has the Star Trek V, the Final Frontier logo underneath. But at the top of the poster, it actually says, "Why are they putting seatbelts in theaters this summer?" And my first thought, seeing that this was a Star Trek V poster, was, well, right. I'm still waiting for an answer, and it's 2012, right. So why were you doing that? But I told you about this on iMessage, yeah. And you told me that this is not the first time that they have done these vintage posters.
No, well, I mean, back when Star Trek II came out, they posed the question, you know, why are theaters using SETI eels this summer?
Yeah, that was one. I think I missed that one as well. Now, I did see the one they did for Star Trek III, though. Did you see this one? It was,
no.
Why is Doc Brown hanging out with Klingons in theaters this summer?
Right. Well, and then there was the first Star Trek. Why does it take so long for Captain Kirk to get to the Enterprise this summer?
That was a quite popular one. yes. And there was the one for Star Trek IV. I don't know if you saw this one. The why is Spock running around in his underwear in theaters this summer? And apparently that one was quite effective. I mean, I think that's one reason why that movie had such a big box office. All the female fans were running there to try to catch a glimpse of Spock in his underwear. Just going to be sitting on the front row, you know, in his Fruit of the Looms or something, eating popcorn with a terracloth headband on or something.
Well, and then there was Star Trek Nemesis, you know, this Christmas. Why on earth is Data singing Irving Berlin?
In theaters.
In theaters.
This Christmas. Right.
But this is an actual poster. I do hope this will be in the show notes. I hope that if you're, you know, looking at this on your iPhone, you can tap the screen and look at it. And if you know the answer, I'm now breaking the fourth wall and addressing our audience. If anyone out there has the answer of why theaters are installing seatbelts so that people can watch Star Trek V, please, please let us know.
Yes, please do. And if you want this poster, you actually can buy it. I will try to put the link to the place that's selling it in the show notes as well. It's $24.99, in fact. So, and apparently it's printed with foil on the poster. So,
wow.
Shiny object for your wall.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone.
So, Greg, apparently Pink Floyd are not the only ones that have a thing for walls. Apparently, J.J. Abrams also has a thing for walls as we move into movie news and rumors, our first one in a couple of shows now.
Right. We've talked on previous shows about how J.J. Abrams was furious that people were taking pictures from the set. And apparently, he's erected a giant wall which can be seen from space dock.
That's what I heard. Yes, it's... the second largest man-made structure on Earth. Is that what I've heard?
That's pretty much it. I don't know. Are they shooting something super secret back there? Is this the scene where Spock and Uhura go to adopt their dog, and you know he wants to protect the secrecy. You know, is it a beagle? Is it a schnauzer? Is it a Shiba Inu?
It might be that scene. I'm really not sure about that, but it probably does have something to do with Spock and Uhura. And you know what I found interesting about this photo of this wall? So am I correct in understanding that the wall is actually comprised of 30 shipping containers?
Yes. I mean, they must have brought in like cranes and stuff to put this thing together. They had like a crew spend half a day dropping shipping containers down in what looks like a parking lot, I guess, between where the public can get to and where... Far behind, they're actually shooting this thing.
Are we sure that these are shipping containers and that this is not actually the set of the Botany Bay?
I suppose that's entirely possible.
What I found interesting in this photo, though, is that if you look up on the hillside behind the shipping container, there are all these big houses up on top of this hill. And you would think, because, hey, you know, I lived in Reno for a while and I had friends who had houses up in the higher elevations that overlooked the valley. You could see for miles and miles and miles. I would have to think that the people in these houses can probably see over this wall.
Well, maybe JJ went by and just got each of those people to pay him a bribe in order to not erect a wall between their houses. And maybe it's all Trekkies up on that hill.
Well, that might be the worst thing that could be. They're the ones who most want. What you need are like, it's like they're all Desperate Housewives fans up there or something. That they have like no interest at all in Star Trek.
And right. Well, did you see the Trek movie? They did a poll. Is there enough or is there too much Star Trek secrecy? Did you see this poll, Chris?
I don't think I saw that one, no.
Okay, well, let me tell you. The options were, well, I guess, here's the lead-in. J.J. Abrams' total Star Trek secrecy is, and then there's three options. Good thing, spoilers ruin the movie experience. Okay, but how about just a little bit more? Or bad, info builds buzz and interest. And I think I'd probably go with, it's okay. How about just a little bit more? I'd like a little bit more information. That is what 48% of people said, that the amount of secrecy is just about the correct level. 36% says that they're doing a good thing. It's perfect. And then 16% said, this is terrible. We want to know everything about the show, about everything about the movie. We want to read the script and see pictures from the set. Now, where do you fall on this, Chris? Do you think he's going a little far?
I don't know. I can completely understand J.J. Abrams' position that he is creating something and he doesn't want, when people go to the theater, he doesn't want them to have already basically seen the whole movie and read the whole script before they ever see it, you know? At the same time, I would agree with people who say that info builds buzz, which is why I think that these pictures come out and stay out, because the studio executives know that this creates buzz and it's good for them. I think that probably my overall position would be that it's up to the fan if you want to seek out this information or not. I think they should let some information out. They shouldn't be just completely secret about it all. And then if you're a fan like me, if I weren't doing a Star Trek show, then I would stay away from it because I wouldn't be totally surprised when I go in. You know, some fans are like that. Some fans just can't wait to find out what the uniform looks like or what the prop looks like or whatever. And so for those people, they can go look for it. So I'm kind of in the, it's the fans' responsibility ultimately to kind of measure what type of information you learn and what you don't.
Right. Yeah. Now we did finally get some news about when we might be hearing some information. We did hear Damon Lindelof told Slash Film that come Comic-Con in July, you know, they will have finished shooting the production of the film in May. So come July, they will probably have something to reveal at Comic-Con in July in San Diego. So that's got me excited.
Yeah, that's nice. Now, am I correct in understanding that what they're talking about doing is showing a 5-minute clip from the movie, things that have been shot so far, but it's going to be in an area. They're going to build a wall using shipping containers. They're going to have this outdoor screen. You can go in one at a time and you can view this. And then as you leave, they're going to poke your eyes out. It's like the architect of St. Basil's Cathedral, right, you know, who was blind. Kind of like that. So you can see it, but the price you pay is your future vision. So,
right.
They don't want you to be sharing any of this information. Is that what I heard? Is that correct?
Are you sure you're not just talking about the Gorn captain who poked out his own eyes after viewing the original J.J. Abrams film?
I could be. Yeah, maybe that. You know, actually, the Gorn captain just sent me a message just a little while ago and just wanted to make sure I knew that he is not Toss.
I saw that. I'm not entirely sure what he was talking about, but I'm glad he's paying attention and he's angry.
Didn't we talk last show maybe about whether they were related or whether they hang out?
We might have. Okay. All right. Yeah. We apparently should be very careful what we say about the Gorn captain on this show.
Maybe so.
The Gorn captain, guys, if you think this is your chance to finally descend on the Gorn captain and take him out, he still has both of his eyes. His teeth are very sharp. Watch out.
do watch out. So, Greg, last thing here in news today. We do have one last bit here related to the movie, and this is the ongoing story of photos and are we seeing new uniforms in the photos. Now, I feel like what we're watching is more like a photo shoot for the J. Peterman catalog of this season's new trench coat lineup, but... we've got more pictures of Zoe Saldana. Boy, they like to take pictures of Zoe, don't they?
Zoe Saldana looks good in a trench coat.
Yeah, pretty much anything. I just noticed that of all the photos that come out, like 9 out of every 10
right.
is a picture of Zoe Saldana. So I have noticed that, but we have...
Some of them aren't even from the Star Trek set. You know, Zoe Saldana right. goes to Walmart. I know. Zoe Saldana's walking her dog, you know.
I like the one where she's waiting in line.
Exclusive pictures of Zoe Saldana at Safeway. She's buying yogurt.
Yeah, I like the one where she's in line at In-N-Out Burger also. That was a really nice one. But we have her, and now we have John Cho, who's also walking around in a trench coat.
Yes.
And
but what's really important, okay, I suppose, is what's underneath the trench coat. Which is apparently some sort of new Star Trek uniform.
I guess. I think they're the gray ones that we saw in the first movie, but maybe there's something else to it.
They look to be, really sure. I don't know, they look to be maybe like spacesuits or something, you know, some sort of variant on, they're not doing away with the colorful uniforms, obviously. But as is mentioned many times, you know, they always wear different uniforms over the course of the movie. Even in the first JJ movie, they did. Certainly, they do in the other Star Trek films. So, the idea that they might be wearing something slightly different is not crazy or out of this world.
Right, right. I thought maybe they're redoing Star Trek V, which we speculated, you know, early on, and they're going to have the cast out of their normal Starfleet uniforms for, you know, like 95% of the movie.
That'd be pretty good. Maybe that explains the trench coats. Maybe they were at a trench coat convention and aliens attacked and they all just had to rush up to the, you know, they still had their trench coats on over their uniforms and they don't have time to take them off until much later in the film.
Or maybe this is going to be a redo of the Next Generation episode, The Big Goodbye, and they're all, you know, playing their Dixon Hill on the holodeck. Maybe there's going to be a holodeck on the JJ Enterprise.
Does that explain John Cho's iPhone? Is that maybe they're on the holodeck and they're just, you know, they're cosplaying early 21st century America?
Yeah, that's probably it. That sounds good to me. All right. Well, that's all we have for news. I am looking forward to actually when the studio finally releases some early official photos. Yeah. You know how they usually release photos of the cast and costume. They don't really give away anything about what the movie's about, but you get to see who the other characters are, who are the guest characters.
I mean,
kind of stuff's going to be nice.
Yeah, I remember early on we got a picture of pretty much everybody on the bridge wearing their uniform. You know, it didn't tell us anything about what was going to happen in the film, but that was one of the first images that really made me feel like JJ got it. That you saw all the characters, you saw them, you know, in character. I think that's important to see these people in character, in uniform, from the show. And that, yeah, it really gave me a good feeling about the film that was to come. And I'm looking forward to getting that again as we're leading into next year's film release.
Thank you.
We've come to know the Klingons as one of the most fleshed out races in all of Star Trek. But it really all started in 1990 during the third season of The Next Generation with the episode Sins of the Father. And today, to talk about Sins of the Father, of course, I have Greg with me. And also with us, we have our Chadish, Larry Nemechek. Welcome back, Larry.
Well, when you are Chadish, you try harder.
Now, Larry, I have a question for you here. I did not know that part of the role of being a Chadish was to lock the Challenger in a broom closet. But you have locked Greg in a broom closet during our news segment today. Now, what was that all about?
Madness, I tell you, madness. I'm pleading temporary insanity under the effect of the spores.
Oh, well, I'm glad that you let him out so he could come back to finish news with me and do the feature, and that you guys are okay enough to continue to support each other here.
I guess so. I'm mind-bending back and forth between TOS movie era and Next Generation early era. So. But I claim judicial restraint or whatever under the old Latin legal axiom, anything for a bad joke. So
there you go.
So, Greg, have you forgiven Larry for locking you away?
I have. I've put it behind me. I will, you know, visit the sins upon his children and his children's children. But me and Larry personally, we're okay.
All right. That's
we great. Are tight, human. Okay.
Well, speaking about
enough of the fake Klingon, because I'll get tripped up on that real soon. Because once you get past Kapla, it's kind of, and Chadish, right. You know, it's kind of poor.
That's pretty much it. All right. Well, talking about sins, Greg, why don't we talk about Sins the Father a little bit? And we're going to talk about, of course, the episode itself. And we also watched the remastered on Blu-ray, which we'll talk a little bit about as we go along as well. So what were your impressions going back and watching Worf and Picard make their little jolly trek to Kronos?
You know, I really liked this episode. It was one that I didn't remember particularly because I think when you watch it sort of in syndication, you don't realize how much it's the first big Klingon episode. It just is like, oh, well, there's another Klingon episode here. They're going to Kronos. They got all these costumes. But when you're watching it in sequence, like I am because I'm watching along with Dork Trek, it's like, wow, this is brand new stuff. And it's really impressive. And especially watching it remastered as I did on the Blu-ray, to see all the colors, see all the costumes, and really see it in the detail. This is a really fantastic early TNG episode.
It is. And you know, knowing that it was the first time that we went to Kronos and we saw the chamber and all, I was impressed with the way that the Klingons were presented and the actors. I mean, Charles Cooper, who played Kimpek, is that right? Kimpek? If I can get my Klingon right there. Yeah. I thought he did a really great job of what we think of as the Klingons now. And I mean, maybe people playing off of his performance over the years, but for a first time visit, it was really effective.
Well, first time in the manner of speaking, because I mean, they had the robe, so they had him back from Five because he'd played.
Yeah, he was on
General
the
Cord on that.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
Yep. Yeah, you notice that right away. It's like, oh, yeah, he is the guy, but he didn't get to do a whole lot in Star Trek V.
No, he didn't. He just sat there and belched, which was kind of, see, that was the you know, it was like Klingons were either the lead characters and you had, you know, Oscar winners or near Oscar winners, or they were just kind of in as throwaway jokes, which was sad. But there's a, you know, motion picture was the first bumpy-headed Klingon, and Mark, you know, Leonard played the first commander. But that whole, when they came to Next Generation, thanks to Worf being in the cast, and they started to go down those shows, and thanks in part to this one, they, you know, the way Michael Westbrook did the heads and the makeup kind of evolved, they had to kind of ramp it up because they didn't have a movie's time and budget to do that. So a lot of the stuff at first you're seeing are recycled movie costumes. But, you know, they had to make them quicker, faster, cheaper, better, cooler, more economical, more affordable. And between Bob Blackman and Mike Westmore, the two of them came together, and you'll see the uniforms, you know, start evolving. But because even in Heart of Glory in the first season, and then a little bit in Matter of Honor in the second season, and then the view screen stuff in Emissary, they didn't need that many. So, you know, here you had the, and they weren't even warriors, but they took warriors and added cloaks and robes and stuff. So,
right.
But yeah, let me. Chris, did you see this first aired? 1990.
Yeah. Okay. I did. Yeah.
I said you really have to. You're going to get to this, but you know, for everybody that was out there really wishing Next Generation would turn the corner and step up. And I want, and what you're saying, Greg, is true, and I'm glad you've got that context. But for so many people, I always talk about Star Trek being the wall o' videos or the wall o' DVDs for people now, where where you think about both the emotional relation to it and just how the show's evolved and all that. And this was not so much that it was 1990, but this was the third season. Michael Piller had come in. The first half season at the beginning, he came in late, so they had lost their head writer, Maury Hurley. Piller came in after Michael Wagner came in and then left, and they all knew each other, but he's talked about the first, well, he doesn't now because he's passed away in 2005, but he talks about how that first season, they were riding the rims, literally. They were like 11th hour rewrites behind, you know, from what he thought the show needed to be, and they were trying to turn it a little more. And all the V episodes, you know, the survivors, the bonding, the enemy, the prize, the vengeance, fact that infected the hunter, the high ground. We laugh about that now, and it was like, I don't care about the titles. But, and my joke was, and I was looking at this, this is the third decent show in a row, not that there hadn't been decent shows. But, you know, yesterday's Enterprise was supposed to be the total cluster F, and it turned out to be, because it was done so badly, and they all threw together the writing and everything. And then it was great, and then The Offspring was wonderful. And then this is Sins of the Father. So like somewhere everything started to kick in, you know, the filming times was in November, but this was done in January of 90, but they really started to turn then. And there were still a couple of clunkers later on. Allegiance came after this, and Captain's Holiday, then Tin Man, then Hollow Pursuits with Barclay and the Most Toys and Sarek and, you know,
Greg
and they
loves
wind up
Barclay,
with Best
by
Most
the
Worlds.
Way.
Yeah. What?
Greg loves Barclay, by the way.
Are you being sarcastic?
I want to know the story behind Barclay, because it's like, why would you introduce this character to the show? I don't know. He gets on my nerves. I guess he's like Wesley for a lot of people, for me.
Why do you have the imperfect, yeah. Well, anyway, Sins of the Father was, you know, aside from being a cool show, it was almost like, you know, the old thing about we won't have original series aliens and all races in, right. So no Vulcans in Next Generation, but they've got Worf to show the time span has changed. So it's like Heart of Glory was like one little crack, you know, open the door and there you are. And then the second season they had Heart of Glory kind of built on that. And then they sneaked Emissary in there toward the end, the Emissary, excuse me. And then I don't know if anybody had any clue how it just blew things wide open. Sins of the Father. But you know, you're watching, I don't care what year you're watching it, you watch that last scene when they all turn their backs on Worf and you realize, oh, this isn't going to wrap up in a neat little bow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you go, oh, you know, now you say, oh, this is cool. But back in 1990, when you're watching, you went, oh my God, they can't leave.
Yeah, I mean,
they can't leave this here. This is going to have to be continued. Oh my God. You know, but it blew your head open that you had Worf's really had a brother. After all this talk about Worf being an orphan and Kittimer and all this just kind of background, they start pulling all that together, and they pull a thread from Heart of Glory, and they pull a thread from Emissary, and they pull a thread from here. And then they spin out so much more stuff that's going to get revisited later. They totally set they've totally set that in motion. Yeah. And
well, even the Duras family, I mean, that plays off all the way into Generations.
Yeah, yeah.
So they really laid all...
And all the way backwards into Enterprise.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, it feels like going into, like, the final act, that they're going to find some way to just wrap it all up, like... Oh, they're going to find out that it was Worf's father after all, and he's going to have to take the shame and go home or something. Or, oh, they're going to say they're going to kill him, but oh, they'll just beam him out at the last second. But it turns out the Duras family is covering this up. The council knows about it. It's trying to avoid civil war. And then, yeah, like you say, that final scene, we think this has got to be like the penultimate scene. Mm-hmm. But no, that's just where it ends. And you expect there to be a big to be continued. It's not even that. It's like, this is just the show. There's so much. This is such a big world. We're going to revisit this eventually. It's not a two-parter. This is just, we just put a whole bunch of threads into the show Bible that we're going to revisit later.
And when you're watching it the first time, I mean, we sit here now and very intellectually say, and this was the first episode to visit Kronos. And this was the first episode to see the Klingon. But if you're sitting there and had never, and you, we talk about, there'd been... three Klingon shows. Okay, one was two Klingon renegades on the ship. One was you were on a Bird of Prey bridge part-time, and then you've got Klingons on the ship. And then Emissary was Klingons on the ship and one guy with a view screen angle on it. This is the first time you went to Kronos. This is the first time it was visualized. This is after all those years of fanzine stories and, you know, whatever, and speculation, you actually see, you know, the first city. And, of course, you notice they're not calling it Kronos because that doesn't come until Star Trek 6.
Yeah, that comes later. Yeah.
They very adroitly say, here we're on the first city of the Klingon Empire, on the home. They for years on TNG,
actually,
they say,
the
Klingon homeworld, the homeworld.
Picard calls it the first city of the Klingon Imperial Empire.
Empire, yeah.
The Imperial Empire. Yes.
And the other thing that always got me about this show was it's always the House of Duras. Even after he dies, it's the Duras sisters, you know, and it's the Duras this, and Duras is the forebear that comes up. It's like in one line you hear that Duras is, in fact, if you look at the pronunciation guide, Picard always says this, Patrick would always say Duras with a Y in it, like D-U-Y, which is actually the way the pronunciation guide says to say it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And everybody's anglified it to Duras. But no one ever says the House of Jerod. It's like there's one line where they say Duras' father was, you know, Jerod. But he was such a memorable character. His was the name that stuck, I guess.
I do notice throughout the episode that they flip back and forth between referring to Khitomer and Khitomar.
Yeah.
That goes on a lot.
There's one line, Picker, where I can hear it in my head where Riker says, I want all available records on the incident at Khitomar.
Yes, you know, that's the biggest one, yeah.
Right.
But yeah, these things are new, and as they get fleshed out, you know, we had the same thing with Bajor, where Picard would call it Bajor quite often.
Well, in the first Bajor, in the Ensign Rose show, they were actually still calling them, they were at first called the Bajora.
Yeah.
And they dropped the A, yeah. But then they also had the little wing tips coming off of the like, looked like little longhorn steer horns.
Well, speaking of the makeup,
I should finish that thought since we're not on video. The steer horns at the top of the crinkle nose, and they came up, but they all those little things, they would like peel up in the heat, so they eased them out.
Oh, is that it? I always thought they made them look really bizarre, and I'm glad they phased those out. I thought they really stepped it up with the Klingon makeup in this one. Like if you look at Kern next to Worf, I know even though Worf is the main character, I thought Kern's makeup looks so much more natural. Like he just sells as a Klingon really well.
Yeah, that's probably because they, you know, they're always reinventing, and they could only Worf was on camera and a regular, so whatever they did to him had to be something they could do every day.
Right.
But they could go that a little overboard on the guests a little bit, maybe, because they only had two or three, you know, it was a 7-day shoot. Yeah, this whole episode was a 7-day shoot, and they spent 3 days on the hall set.
When I look at the Klingons, though, I sometimes wonder because I picture, you know, from the anatomy. If this is kind of, you know, like a bone structure on the forehead, and then you look at someone like Kern, I thought looked really good, and Duras, I thought looked kind of, he had like this big, thick, circular thing coming around his head. It's like really thick, and I thought that seems like a very odd way for your skull to grow. So
the thing when they redid them in motion picture, the idea was that the spine, like on a human, you can see the spine sticking out unless there's too much fat in the way. The idea was that the Klingon spine, like where the bony part came out a little bit, went up your back
just
and came up
going
over your head and came down and ended at your nose instead of at your which I just always knew that. And then we get a situation like this and I go, oh yeah. But then at times you'll see the back of a bald Klingon and they don't, you know, as the years and generations of oversight would turn over, you might not get that.
Right.
But that was the original idea, was that their spine just continued up over and came up over there.
But then it seems that they, in Next Generation forward, they really got into creating unique foreheads for different characters, I guess, to visually differentiate, you know.
Well, it really came
characters.
Up in when they got to Redemption. I need to go back and look at that, but I know by the time of Redemption, it became about like DNA and family lineage. So your forehead kind of resembled so the Duras sisters and Toral were modeled on Duras's in this a little bit. But.
Okay. Which that makes sense. I mean, that's a nice way to go, as long as it's not
it also cut down on the insanity of coming up with, you know, like 14 Klingon.
Well, that's the thing. I think sometimes the makeup is really well done and it looks natural. Like you can really see that, this is how it would be. And then sometimes it's kind of like, I think with Duras here, a bit it deviates too much from what could possibly be natural, and so come in with new things. But definitely, yeah, I thought Kern in particular looked quite good in here, and it holds up really well on the Blu-ray as well.
Yeah, it did. It's almost like it's not fair, because if it looks good, then you don't. It's kind of like when you're mad is when you write a flaming comment or a letter to the editor, you know. But when you're satisfied with something, you sit back happy. It's kind of like if things are looking good, you don't stop and think about it. And I need to remember how great this looked, unless it knocks you out of your chair. But yeah,
right. Oh, I did have a question that came up when I was watching this. Is this Kronos? Because later Star Trek VI. Praxis explodes and there's the natural disaster. Am I confused that they had to move their homeworld to some other planet?
I explained this to you yesterday, Greg. But let's see what Larry's...
Did you explain it?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's Larry's explanation?
I remember researching this because they were talking about they'd have to, you know, the. I think they come up with... This was never said on camera anywhere, because people kind of went, oh, that was... The people who were running the last movie never were in charge of anything again, so nobody really worried a lot about it. But we have to just – no, they haven't moved the home world. It's not like the founders got up and left when they had to. Kronos is Kronos, so the home world is the home world, yeah. Okay. And
so Praxis just wasn't as bad as it was supposed to be. Well, it was like Fox News.
Yes. Right? My explanation to Greg, Larry, was that what happened is that Praxis exploded, right? But the Federation News Service, what happened is that over the centuries, Fox News and CNN, they merged with each other and they became the Federation News Service. So they just blew that whole Praxis thing like way out of proportion. And there was no real danger to Kronos itself. And so that's why they're still on Kronos.
Kronos, out of danger? Okay.
That's a good one.
Because somehow growing up, I always assumed that there was an old Kronos and a new Kronos. But then as I watch these episodes and I'm trying to like find that set on camera somewhere, I can't.
Yeah.
Don't see it. So apparently, yeah, it just Praxis exploded and everything was kind of fine.
It's fine.
Yeah. Now, you were talking about the Hall. The Hall won an Emmy. I mean, the art direction on the show won Richard James, who was the production designer, and Jimmy Meese was the set dresser, and all the art staff. Did get an Emmy for this, and mainly because of the Klingon Hall, and they kept it. And what's funny is, like, when the next time they went back to the Hall was, I guess the only other time, was on DS9 with the House of Quark. They only pulled about half of it out, so they didn't, like, bother to put the whole set up again.
Of the Hall that we saw in TNG, right? Because in Enterprise, they go to the Hall,
but it's a small,
it's kind of retro because it's supposed to be...
A couple hundred years earlier. And even on this, when they shoot the reverse angles, like here's Picard and Worf facing down the council, these wonderful graphics, it's just too bad they won't be in the audio version. When they're facing and they're, you know, you think about shooting back this way and they've got the wall behind the council, but then they do have to have something when they shoot this way, and they just cheated and, I mean, they just turned them. There's not really like a four-wall or a three-wall set. It's the long wall and the ceiling piece, and then behind the council. Of course, it's all smoke. It's typical Klingon smoke. So you spend $4 billion on a set for a Klingon show or a ship, and then you see, you know, like 50 cents worth because the smoke is...
Right.
That's the eternal thing of the camera crew versus and lighting versus the set guys, this art department.
But talking about the Hall, I really have been loving watching this on the Blu-ray because... You really see the level of production value that went into that set, and it's just beautiful. Yeah. And to think that even in the third season of The Next Generation, that they were putting that much effort and attention to detail and money into the set is very impressive.
Yeah, and the Blu-rays hopefully will get people back to some, because that really was, it was, it's not like, you know, like one department on the show hated another department. It's kind of like the nature of the beast. And you never know exactly, but you would put detail or you would spend money on something. And it's not like in a production meeting, they'd say, okay, now we're buying this, you know, antique 400-year-old desk over here. So make sure and use it in 15 different camera shots. I mean, they don't have those kind of discussions. So if something
is cool, otherwise in schisms, they would have been operated on top of that desk, right?
Otherwise, and then it, yeah, then Schisms is the one show where they don't have the smoke where they wanted it,
right?
And they show them. But
I mean, speaking of that, in this episode, but not on Kronos, there is the scene where Geordi and Data and Riker, I believe, are in front of the computer panels, you know, and they're looking up all this information.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, I've seen that so many times in the standard definition, and you just feel like, oh, they're sitting at a control panel on the bridge and they're looking at something. But on the Blu-ray, when you can see all that detail, it feels massive. It's so impressive.
And that's why there used to be an old hobby, at least I thought me and maybe four other people in the world did it, but I had a forehead VCR recording that and then going back and looking on a regular TV tube, you know, and trying to pull off all the little all the in jokes and the accoutogram. Yeah, yeah. To me, that's what that was. And my, you know, one of the fun things about doing my old original TNG books was everything that I could pull off and put in there, I'd try to do that because people weren't even aware it was there. But yeah, the fact that Mike sat there and back in this day, this is third season, it was just Mike. I mean, Okuda. Like he had people on. Well, it was Mike and Rick. But as far as graphics went, he was a one-trick pony. Wow. He didn't have, you know, like later on, Doug and Jeff Mandel and Jim Vanover and more somebody doing animation. He was doing the stills. He was doing what passed for animation, you know. So all of that is his fun stuff. But the fact that they would try to put those entries in there, you know.
Yeah, I know on the original series, there were a lot of things that were way too small to be seen. So they put a lot of jokes in there. And I feel like with the Blu-rays, we're seeing a level of detail that I had no idea was there on some of these screens. Like maybe when they put the screen really big on screen, you could read it before. But now, as you say, little things and stuff like the Enterprise written on the side of the hull during the opening credits as as the Enterprise pans past camera. It's like, wow, we're supposed to be reading where it says Enterprise there. But I always just thought, oh, well, that's just you're looking at the ship.
That's just the pivot point that happened to fall. Yeah,
it's just a pivot point. But yeah, but you're supposed to be just following where it says Enterprise right there on the hull. It's like,
well, now, I don't know if it's any clearer or not, but you know from day one, they put, and since it was the credits, they could spend the money and it would be there for forever. And ILM did the original stuff. But you know, as the ship passes right before the warp effect at the end of the credits, you can see that's supposed to be Picard walking in the,
And I thought that was a digital effect. And I was all up in arms that they'd added digital effects to Next Generation. And then I went back to the standard def. And if you look really, really, really closely, yeah, it's absolutely there.
Yep. But you have to know to look for it. You go back.
Right.
Like now what you're talking about on the neck where it says Enterprise, now when I went back and I looked for it, I can see there's like dark, I mean, you can't read it, but there's like this dark smudge across the neck. So it was there all the time, but you just don't even pay attention.
Yeah, yeah. Now we were talking about, one thing we should say though about the hall was one of the reasons why they were able to make it quite this big and detailed, and it is cool to go back and even through the Klingon token smoke to be able to see that kind of detail, was that Richard James was really good about reusing sets. And so if they like had to build a big, like the bones of the Great Hall go back to the Ensigns of Command. And they would kind of keep, if they could keep a set kind of standing on, Ensigns of Command. They would keep a set standing on 16 if they could. And like if they knew that a script was coming down the pike, like maybe not the next slot, but the script after that, and they needed a thing, they would kind of keep that and then like rework pieces and, you know, and build it up. So the thing that was in, if I go backwards, Offspring was a bottle show. Yesterday's Enterprise was a bottle show. Matter of Perspective was the Tanaga station. They used it there. You know, High Ground, where it was the Hunted with the super soldiers, and the High Ground. Those were like off-planet shows that needed, you know, some aliens, some planetary sets. And I'm not saying that it was like a cookie cutter thing. They would take, you know, pieces and move, but they would have those big pieces and redo and repurpose. And, you know, some of the things were famous now for the really distinctive stuff that gets reused, but some of the real generic stuff would be reused. They did that a lot the last season too. The village that winds up with the Cardassians and the Native Americans had been used for several times before that, kind of the same way. Mm-hmm. But that's how you're talking about how they spent the money. That's one of the ways they did it, like with everything else. In fact, they had just, this was also, everybody needs to remember, this is the first year of the two-part costumes, right? First, second season had the spandex killers. Yeah, and they've, right. and the actors finally, but they're still phasing out the old ones. They made them two-piece. So if you watch when they, it reminded me, they walk in to get Kern in the transporter, and the transporter officer is wearing one of the first season.
Yeah.
With the yeah, beating.
If you look in
the
background, a bunch of the shots, it has the, yeah, the beating. Yeah, I love these suits. I've somewhere on Memory Offense, probably from your book, it says those suits cost $3,000, which, as a fan who'd love to have a cinema quality version, it's like $3,000. Oh goodness.
And that's 1989 dollars.
Exactly. I'm sure to the, I mean, but even to the show's production, that's not cheap when you talk about costuming every single person and all the extras.
Yeah, yeah. Now the, you know, your beauty cast and guest stars get the modern thing. And that's why they, yeah, they would recycle them, generally wean them out, you know, with all the extras in the background.
Yeah. Yeah. My roommate was watching the show with me last night and, you know, she'd never seen this particular TNG episode before. And she was noticing like, okay, this is a low budget show in general, but this episode for her stood out as one that looked like they spent a lot of money. Now, was it that way at the time? You know, did they have to save up money and do a few bottle shows to be able to afford this, or did they just do it?
Yeah, they were going
to
do. They were going to end budget. Season 3 with Shades of Grey Part 2.
Well, I mean, no, that was a fact. I mean, it would come and go. Now, again, look, go backwards and look at the production. Before Sins of the Father was The Offspring, which was very. I mean, probably the most they had to spend on were the two or three aliens in makeup in the holodeck for, you know, and poor what's his face in the gold outfit that he was glued into. You know, other than that, it was all a bottle show. Leonard John Crowfoot, I'm sorry. And Yesterday's Enterprise was a bottle show, but they, you know, they had the explosions and stuff. Matter of Perspective, they had the big set, which was the forebear of this, and they had they had some cast in it. And Deja Q was pretty much a bottle show. High Ground and The Hunted and The Defector were, you know, a close humanoid. I mean, so yeah, you can see where there's back and forth. They're trying to save. Oh, you know, here's a point. We were talking about Worf and Klingons and how this show kind of blew up. They didn't take the safe route at the end, like in the last scene we're talking. And if you go, I go back up the thing, and really the first time that happened, because I know Michael Dorn used to gripe about this the first couple of years, but it's like the first couple of years, the main thing they used Worf for, if it wasn't a Klingon show, was if the alien entity or the guest bad guy of the week could beat up Worf, then you know he was really badass.
Exactly. Yeah.
And Michael's like, I'm supposed to be the Klingon. It's kind of like Archer getting beat up all the time in Enterprise. It's like, really, guys?
Right,
do you have to, you know, or the transporter failing, in, you know, or holodeck in next year? And, you know, at least if nothing else, those Klingon shows let Worf finally get to be noble before he had to go back and be the barometer of beat-up ability, you know?
That's very true.
So the one that kind of signaled, I think, a change for that, if nothing else, was back a little bit earlier in The Enemy, which was like Enemy Mine, you know, and then later Dawn on Enterprise. But it's basically one of our guys is marooned with his worst enemy, and they have to learn to get along. Okay.
Right.
So Geordi's in the pit with the Romulan, and on the ship is the dying Romulan. And remember, there's a whole little bit about Worf.
Right.
They need Worf's blood to, you know, and Crusher's being her good,
donate.
You know, her good Federation Prime Directive, you know, oh, please give him blood and we'll save him and we'll be friends. And Worf says, no way, I hate Romulans. And that was such a shock. And Michael Dorn was shocked at the time. He's like, you can't make Worf a bad guy. And what he came to see, and it was a very bold thing that Michael got them to do, and what they came to see was, oh, this is, how else are we ever going to get some texture here if we don't go against the grain? You know. And so you go from that to, no, we don't wrap up Sins of the Father in a bow and have everything hunky-dory at the end. So after that, it was like, okay, you know, the door's wide open now. You know,
that's where you feel the show is maturing.
And then after this comes new ground. Oh, let's kill Dora. You know, hey, have Worf go in and kill him on his own terms. You know, it's in Klingon honor code. It's cool. He'll kill his mate, and you know, and then you're off and running from there. And
Well, yeah. I mean, I really liked we had done the episode where Riker goes on the Klingon ship, and I think when this episode starts, you think they're just going to do the opposite version. It's going to be, look at the Klingon, and he can't fit in with the rest of the crew, and isn't it funny how he growls at Wesley?
And makes comments about their food, and
Rubs caviar on the turkey, on the burnt bird meat.
I feel like this was
burned.
The prequel.
Yes. Bird meat.
This was sort of the precursor of the dinner scene in Star Trek VI, where we have, I can't think of another time on TNG where we have everybody sit around a table eating turkey.
Yeah.
But it's perfect for this episode.
There is the other one later. There's the scene later on where they're having the banquet. In seventh season, they're not Klingons, but they're Yarens, the three guys, and they're all getting, one guy's getting drunk and they're all critiquing the food.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it, yeah. Oh, there's a, here, before we leave, for trivia fans, do you know where they were eating when they had that meal that Kern was insulting the food?
Well, it certainly looks like the same banquet hall that they use in the Undiscovered Country, is it?
Well, it technically was the same set, but they were using the Observation Lounge.
Okay.
Or the conference. Yeah, it should have been called the conference lounge, but they always...
The conference room, yes.
But it wasn't. In fact, in the elevator scene, in the turbo lift scene before that, he says, are you going to the captain's mess or the captain's dining hall?
Supposed to be a different place, but it's the same...
It's supposed to be on the outer rim with a window, but it has the conference room famous, you know, iconic windows over there.
Yeah.
But hall, the room is redressed. I mean, there's no...
Because that was supposed to be I guess it's the first time, I don't know if it's the only time that we saw Picard has his private dining room. Like on Enterprise, we saw Archer has a private dining room, which we see from time to
time.
Tiny
one. Yeah. And you were supposed to see it on, well, not supposed to, but Neelix's kitchen took over where Janeway's
That was
going to
be Janeway's,
Right.
But the script and the call sheets call that room the captain's dining room. So it was intentionally supposed to be a minor redress from but they're sitting at the observation lounge, the conference lounge table.
Doesn't this tell you something that so Picard has his own little dining room, but yet when Beverly comes over for breakfast, they always cuddle up together on the sofa? What does that tell you?
Oh, that's called tea for two, sir. That's what that's called.
Right. But I like the idea that Picard has this little room and he's got his little carving knife, and every once in a while he just invites the senior staff over, you know, staff dinner, and just says, you know, let's forget about all of our troubles.
And he doesn't have to have a dad that has a Cajun restaurant or a Creole restaurant to do it.
Right.
But no, I mean, the idea was that, I mean, when they sat down and you know, blue skied the show, the idea was to get around to all those kinds of, and there would be special rooms all over the place. One of the wacky things is, and it was an early show in Haven, the whole thing of Mr. Hom hitting the gong, that whole thing that's trying to be funny, and it's kind of like painfully edited together. And they're insulting each other, you know, and the Millers and all that. That's supposed to be in like a banquet hall in the dorsal. It says deck whatever dining hall. But the idea was that those kind of rooms are all over the big day. It was another part of this is way bigger than that little tiny, you know, submarine of a ship that Kirk had, was the idea.
We were talking about this last week. We were talking about motion picture last week, and they go to all these gigantic rooms, like the rec room that Decker takes the Elia unit to. It's like, this is inside of the Enterprise, because it never would have been there on the original show. And it definitely would have been cool to see more of that on TNG.
Yeah, we were talking about how on the TV series, even though these ships are so big, it just feels like you just go from tiny room to tiny room. But in the movies, you actually get to see that there are these large spaces like that. So,
yeah.
So you're saying they had the plans to do that on the Next Generation, but they obviously with the budget can never really quite do it.
Well, the perfect example there is Stellar Cartography on Next Generation was the little room with the little bubble console and all that. And then they go to Generation, and it's like, oh, here's the really cool room that we never showed you in. You know, it's like, it's the same room, but then you go through that door over at the side, and now here's this big, cool 3D hollow star projector thing, and Picard and Data could sit out here in this little suspended in space seat here, and ooh, it's very cool looking.
It's like you're normally at home, you've got a computer with like three displays connected to it where you can do all your work, but instead, most of the time, you just pull out your iPhone and just do everything on there.
Yeah, you know.
They just use the bubble stellar cartography most of the time.
Yeah.
And wasn't Picard supposed to have a yacht too, like his own like giant shuttle?
Oh yeah,
that is at the bottom of the, and they never got around to it. I feel like it's the Raider in Battlestar that they never got around to building the set.
I was just getting ready for this tonight. I was going back through some notes, and Mike and every time I say Mike and Rick, I have to remember to say Okuda and Sternbach, not Piller and Berman. They for several years would go up to Baycon in San Francisco and do a slideshow, And I, you know, back in the early internet, I was pulling that off because I was so desperate in my 6 months of doing the first edition of The Companion on no prep time, was pulling all the details like that I could pull because there was no internet, no tech manual, no nothing then. And they were always trying to get that into a show, but it's pre-CGI, and they would have to build a model. And the thing I was looking at, I think they were talking about it costing, in those dollars again, like $35,000 to build just the little model. Then they'd have to build the set. Then they'd have to do some model work to show the you know, if you wanted to actually show it launching from the bottom of the saucer. So all of that, you know, now in on Voyager, there was some CG done. They did the same thing. There's a little ship that comes off the bottom of Voyager's hull. Of course, it's a totally different scale. It's a much smaller ship. But they did some CG and had it ready to go and never had a story. After they did the Delta Flyer, it's like, well, that's our cool little signature ship. And who needs a captain's yacht that looks like a cargo plane here at the bottom of the thing? But they actually, I've seen, and I think it's on online somewhere, YouTube now, where,
I'm surprised they couldn't come up with some kind of storyline where Harry takes the yacht out and gets killed. I mean, that would have, they could just thrown that in as a B story.
I think they did, didn't they? No, I'm kidding. And then at the like in late in the show when they had the in Timescape, they tried again to make that be the captain's. But they had just launched DS9. If you remember, it was like the one time a runabout was on TNG, and the only time you saw the back end of a runabout, it's like the front end was designed by Herman Zerman, the DS9 staff, but the back end was designed by Richard James and the Next Gen staff, and you only saw it in this one show. And they did that because, rather than say, they could have just built a set and said, oh, this is the back end of the captain's yacht, and we're going into a movie. Maybe we can go ahead and spend a little money here. Or fake it, you know. Just say, we're aboard the captain's yacht, and it just cuts inside, which would be a horrible cheat, and people would scream, but, you know, without showing the exterior. But the fact that they had launched DS9 and wanted to remind everybody, oh, this is that new little ship, the runabout, and it's another, it was some more like cross show pollination, you know, like having Bashir on.
Right.
On, so. But yeah, they wanted to. I mean, the art, it's like everything else. Yeah. The art staff was itching to do the captain shot, and all the fanboys would love it.
Well, that's where the new, I'm going to talk about Battlestar again.
So say we all.
The new show that they're doing, the pilot's coming out, was basically all shot on green screens. So they didn't even bother to build any sets for this thing. And I can't imagine. I guess in 2012, it's cheaper to do that than to build a new set for every episode. But it seems outrageously expensive to have the CG guys go in and mess with every single
shot.
Well,
what's the budgetary, what am I trying to say? How solid is the position of the thing? I mean, like, if it catches, where is it? Is this a spec? Is it a pilot? Is it, you know, I would, once you get more solid footing, you wouldn't do a whole show on green screen.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking they were thinking, if this gets picked up for a series, we'll build the sets. Because then you end up with something like Lost, where the pilot was, what, $12 million? Because they had to shoot it all in location and build these huge things. And if that hadn't gone to series, that would have been a very expensive movie of the week.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they thought whatever it was they spent on The Cage Where No Man's Gone Before was a lot of money, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, while we're talking about Battlestar, Greg, now, this episode is this episode was kind of like Ronald D. Moore's test bed for some later storylines, right?
Well, no, this comes out of the original Battlestar Galactica, just the new one.
That's a good point.
But all the time I'm watching this movie, I'm thinking they're doing Battlestar, that Worf's father is apparently Baltar, and he gave the command codes to the Cylons, I mean the Romulans.
Yeah.
Although, well, he used to wear Baltar's baldric until they changed it to metal in second season. So,
is that
I'm
right?
Kidding. No, he was wearing Kor slash.
Yeah, he was wearing Kor.
Right. John Colicos's actual, sash.
Sash. Yeah. Right.
The original series sash was gold in season one until they went metal.
Oh wow! I never made that connection.
Yeah, it's the same.
I knew that Kor and Baltar was the same guy. I realized that after I watched Errand of Mercy and the Battlestar pilot, like one after another, by coincidence.
What's the matter, Greg? Is your brain a vegetable? Okay.
No, Greg.
You have to be an Errand of Mercy fan to get.
Yes.
Get my bad impersonation of John Colicos.
Greg watches, he watches them alternating. He watches a Battlestar episode and then a Star Trek episode and then a Battlestar and then a Star Trek so that he can look for all the parallels so that when we do a Ready Room, yes, he can talk about them on the show. Well, I will say that
very sick.
I will say at least for Baltar that having Six around as an accomplice was she was a bit more attractive than K-List was here in Sins of the Father.
Okay, you know, when I was saying John Colicos, I meant the original Battlestar. Of course, I was
right. Of course,
talking about what's his face on what's its name. Yeah.
Yes. Let's see. I guess we should spend a little bit of time talking about the plot of the actual episode at this point.
Which Galactica episode?
Chris, what did you? Right. No, we're going to talk about Blood on the Scales.
Oh,
from
okay.
the fourth season. Okay. Lead into the finale. Ronald D. Moore was really on fire. But no, in this episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, it is really an interesting storyline that they get into. Chris, what did you think way back 1990? You learned that Worf's father...
Thank you. From so long ago. Memories
actually,
from so long ago.
Chris was only two and he wasn't allowed to run the family TV. So,
hey, that's not true. Oh.
I'm gonna point this question to Chris. You know, Chris saw the episode when I watched this episode when it first aired to get right down to it. They had me propped up in front of the TV, feeding me some mashed.
Since you couldn't hold your head up by yourself yet, right?
Your mom was mashing the portable TV up against her belly because you were about 3 months away from delivery or something. Okay.
That's why Greg came out speaking Klingon first.
In utero trecchio, yeah.
He looked at his mom and he said, Chadish!
I'm not second to anyone, kid. Oh, yeah.
What was the question I was asking? I think I was going to ask you what you thought of how this, what you thought of Worf before this episode aired and then after, as this really expanded who he was and, you know, showed his family, showed his history, showed how he felt about honor and all of that. Lots of things that we didn't really know about him before this episode.
I guess it's pretty much what we talked about earlier with Larry about how up to this point, Worf was just kind of there to show that the Federation and the Klingons were friends now. And he, like you said, he was the barometer of how strong the alien was that had come on the ship. And
he would get the occasional, you know, like, nice planet, you know.
Yeah,
right.
You know, the little curt little comedy line, because it's so cute to have a Klingon say, talk about, you know, love poems and hurling objects and all that kind of thing. So,
but, you know, I mean, when they started Next Generation, Worf was just kind of this background character that was just there. And and then he evolved a bit, of course, after he became security chief when Yar left. But I guess he became security chief because he was the strongest guy on the ship. And, I mean, who, you know, you're not going to put Wesley Crusher as security chief, so.
Well, he was the roving, yeah, he was supposed to be a 13-week, you know, occasional actor, like number one among the recurring cast to
just
come.
There.
And right. He was so dominant in the pilot, they went, oh, we got to have him back there. But he was kind of like the roving, we'll have, that, there's the one scene where he's knocked out in Picard goes Electric Blue, Lonely Among Us. And it's they make a point of, he's in that like subset set, and when the thing attacks him, he's like, I'm in sensor maintenance. And they're like, you know, Mr. Worf is part of your familiarization with all parts of the ship. It's like the roving guy that had no, you know, at least Geordi got to sit in the front and make wisecracks before he became chief engineer.
I'm pretty sure you guys don't watch the Disney Channel that much, but with my kids, I see all these shows. There's like Manny. He's like a handyman, Handy Manny. They in the town that he lives in, they call him for everything. You know, the fountain in the park doesn't work. He has to come fix it. The elevator's broken. He has to come fix it. Someone needs a birdhouse built. And my wife was watching and she said, you know, if the elevator breaks, I want an actual engineer that works on elevators to come fix this elevator. I don't want the guy that was just building a birdhouse for Mrs. Smith last episode. So Worf's like roaming around the ship. He's familiar. He's kind of familiar with everything on the ship if someone needs a hand, but...
So, Chris, you're saying you watch Next Gen, you watch Star Trek, and then the Disney Channel, and then Star Trek again, and then the Disney Channel, and you're looking for parallels.
Exactly, yes, that's right. That's what I do. That's how I spend my days.
We're just elevating the level of Star Trek scholarship to all new heights here.
But back Zenus to the answer, Greg, was that I was always a little bit bothered with Next Generation, how they tried to avoid having original series elements. You know, we talked about Vulcans, and you always saw Vulcans
in the beginning,
up to this point, and
until they got their comfort zone.
You saw Vulcans on the Next Generation, but for the most part, they were just background people that you see through windows in engineering, or they're roaming down the hallways. You know, and the same with Worf with the Klingons. It's like Worf's there, but it's not really Klingons. So this was the point, yes, where you felt like, okay, they're going to do something with the Klingons. And mm-hmm. Worf, who became one of the great characters in Star Trek because of his time on Deep Space Nine, and they had more and more time to flesh out who Worf is as a character. Seeing that kind of starting here, was something that, of course, like Larry said earlier, when it happened, you didn't know yet what they were going to do with it, but you did at least see that there's something going on here, and the show's maturing, and we're going to get some storylines that show, Greg, like we talk about often on here with Deep Space Nine, we talk about it, the depth of the Star Trek universe, and it's not just everything's wrapped up nicely at the end of every episode, and everyone has a laugh, and then we go into the next one.
Yeah. I call it the Flintstone laugh at the end. But because no one, I mean, Michael didn't know. Ron Moore had no clue that he was about to get branded as the Klingon guy, you know, much less where the saga would take off. But he was thrilled that they let him keep it open ended, you know, like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but I mean, look what it did. It sets up, look what it did for Picard. Here's Picard sticking his nose into, I mean, they have an alliance, but he's gone to the capital. He's gone to the Oval Office, you know, mm-hmm. of the Klingon Empire, basically. Well, the Oval Office and the inner room of the Speaker of the House, kind of a thing. He's gone into the innards of Klingon government and said, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. I'm arguing this. And then when it really comes down at the end, you know, they're saying, hey, you got no standing here. And he's like, oh, no, now you're talking to me as a captain of this ship that's part. Because look at what happens later on when they get to the Klingon Civil War. You know, when they're running the whole Prime Directive versus Khitomer Accords delicate balancing act. And, you know, it goes all the way from my officer is resigning to fight in the Klingon Civil War. In Reunion, Reunion and then Redemption, where he helps crown Gowron as the new chancellor.
Right.
He's on the on the right side, even though Gowron's Mr. Outsider politician. But it's the right thing to do and knock down the Duras's, you know, craftiness. And then the Civil War. And then you get to Rifle Air, where they change the whole government of the Klingon Empire in the observation lounge of the Enterprise. You know, and it doesn't start a war. They kind of grumble about, here's Picard changing our internal sovereign empire governmental status again. You know, so Mr. Ambassador, you know, Picard's whole ambassadorial charisma thing, it's not just I'm going to help out the crappy little miners fighting over some cave and I'll almost get killed in the crappy shuttle named for Larry Nemechek kind of a thing. Ha ha ha. You know, or the high ground or something. And let's get out of here. These people are going to, you know, are impossible. This is really, I was thinking of that watching it today. This is really one of the first, you know, bits that elevates him out of the minor leagues of being Mr. Ambassador, Mr. Negotiator, and starts, you know, pushing him down that road of I can hold my own in the inner councils of any damn enemy or ally you got, you can throw at us.
Yeah, and he didn't surrender a single time in the course of this episode.
Right. Neither did he set the self-destruct.
So, right. Yeah. Actually, I mean, he's got his whole plot where he goes after...
Or blow up a computer.
Yes. Right. He goes after Kalos, like he goes out by himself into the city, like into the slums. And Worf, you know, Worf has this whole thing where he says, you can't go. And he's like, you know, I'm the Chadish. I can totally go and do this. Yeah, this is not the Picard from the first season for sure.
Even before that, when Worf is with him, and Worf is like kind of not trembling, but he's very much in Starfleet command line, and he's walking in and like requesting to do this. And Picard says, right. Oh, no, you're not going to go blah, 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 blah. And it's kind of like, oh, here it comes. And Picard says, I'm going to go with you. And you're like, oh.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Larry did it. Oh. Greg said. Greg was watching with his roommate. And when Picard agreed to go with Worf, she said, oh. Isn't that sweet, you know? And I told Greg, I said, we need to ask Larry. Let's say that to Larry and see if Larry says, aw.
Yeah, but it's already there. It's perfect.
And you did that's, it on your
that
own.
Really,
Larry.
You really threw me because I did this flashback to WonderCon because my Trekland Between the Cracks panel at WonderCon, it got into this rhythm where about every fifth or sixth thing I said just came. We were just going through my regular show with new stuff in it, but. And for some reason, every, you know, eighth or tenth thing I said would be a line, and there was this one section of the audience, and they weren't, like, faking. It was like, they'd go, aww. And after the fourth or fifth time, I'm like, we're just a really sympathetic bunch tonight, aren't we? And anyway, so you threw me when you did that. I was like, wait, that was funny. How did you know that? Wait.
Well, it's all the spy cameras we have around everywhere.
Like that new reality show on the restaurant diner, whatever it is. It's anyway. I don't want to segue that or sidebar that. It's just a sad time in the world where the newest cable network reality show is not just a cooking show or a here's how I save your restaurant. It's here's how I put security cameras in your restaurant to show how your employees are acting.
Wow.
It's on the food channel.
Even more happy that I don't watch TV.
Hey, this is somebody who only watches two or three shows, you know, really regularly a week. So anyway. But it's really funny how this show also shows the maturity of the writing, where they went back to Heart of Glory. You know, you think about Heart of Glory being a dead-end show. And I mean dead-end as in, here's Worf. It's really the first Klingon show ever of the modern era. And these renegades come on the ship, and they all die eventually. And, and you know, we just learn a little bit about Worf. And you tend to think in your head that's what Heart of Glory was. And the great shot of falling down on they finally use the levels in engineering around the warp core for something, and it's kind of cool camera work.
Right. But
that's the show where you laid out the whole thing about Worf and Khitomer and the massacre. All of that is put out in
that's
that show. In fact, what's really wacky in that was the thing I waited for years. I was working on my book even after 5 years and then found this out. There was even the little side story about how he grew up on the farming world of Galt, you know, with human whatever, which never got referred to back again. I think maybe they did. But I kept wanting to go, I want to know where's his human half-brother? His human half, which finally, you know, was Paul Sorvino later on played that. But there's like these things that are just like amazing, especially compared to some of the other shows, the series later on, their characters. In the first season, they just threw out this, they just vomited up all this backstory for Worf. And then you think about Matter of Honor, the Klingon officer exchange. That really was way more about Riker being on the Klingon ship than it was about Worf. You had to put costumes and makeup on a bunch of Klingons and build a set. So they were getting Klingon-y. But it really wasn't a lot to do about Worf until you got to Emissary, and that was just Susie Plaxton playing Kalar, and you had a Klingon on a view screen, and that's all that one was. So this was really a show that went back to the Maury Hurley years and pulled up a lot of that stuff, and then kind of like freshed it and re-kickstarted it and put it back in motion again, all the whole thing. And in this show brings up that Kern was with this guy named Lorg, and it was the Intrepid that was the first ship, and then you set up for Saragi to be from the Intrepid later, and, you know, in family.
Right.
You even get it, you actually, this picks up in, it's actually just a few episodes later, now that I stop and think about that. We were overlooking that.
So,
a third of family was about Worf and his step-parents visiting, but that was set up by, you know, all of this.
So all of this wasn't in the show Bible back in Farpoint. This was all just made up as they were going along. Every time they did a Klingon episode, let's throw in some more Worf.
Oh, yeah.
That's incredible.
Worf's not in the original writer's guide because he was a recurring character. I mean, if I'd known this, I would turn around and pulled it out over here and looked. But yeah, he's not in the he's not in the writer's guide at the beginning. Are you having a little fanboy moment there, Greg?
I'm impressed that he's not in the writer's guide at the beginning, because I guess I would have assumed that all the stuff that they're saying in I forget the name of the episode, Matter of Honor, was just stuff that they already knew about Worf, and they're just waiting for a chance
to actually say it on the air. Data's background between the writer's guide and Data lore in the first season. It's that if you ever hear one of the writers say, somebody says, why don't you do a story about X? And they go, well, you know what? We'd love to, but we just don't have a good story to hook it on. And that's really the truth. Now, you've got the types like J. Michael Straczynski, who writes all of, you know, I've written all 92,000 episodes of Babylon 5, you know, out of the gate. And they're all ready right now. And that's wonderful. And, you know, or what's his name on West Wing or something. But no, most of the time, unless, you know, even this, even when they have like major, I think the writers now with serialized shows, you know, all, you know, from Lost and all that, I mean, they I think they have tighter arcs in their head starting out. But, I mean, on DS9, they were originally going to have Odo finding who his people were to be the finale of the series.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I made you both And then as they got started with the with the third season, they said, why don't we go ahead and have Odo find out that who his people are, and they're the bad guys, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And let's play with that for 6 years, so.
I paused because I was just picturing how Deep Space Nine would have ended if that had been the finale and the whole Founders Dominion.
Well, you could have had the Dominion War and blah, 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 blah.
You could have still had
been
them fine.
Odo wasn't emotionally tied to, but then you wouldn't have all the stuff of Odo being corrupted back and forth, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All that would have been
missing. And
you
Odo
could still have two-thirds of the,
two-thirds
of the Dominion War could have gone on as it was, but.
True, but Odo never would have become the really interesting and fascinating character that he became as a result of all of that. So,
yeah, well.
And I guess the same thing's true of.
The interesting, fascinating character the way we know it.
Right, exactly. Right. I'm sure they would have done something totally different with him. But I'm thinking of, you know, Worf, I guess, could have just stayed in the background. But think of what TNG would have been. Think of DS9 if they'd never gone there. If they just did kind of what they did with the Vulcans and just sort of continued to ignore them for years. It becomes such a part of the shows that we love.
Yeah, well, it's like, it's true of anything. Where you're standing now and you look back, it's like when things are evolving, you have no idea where things are going to go. There's time, like I remember watching yesterday's Enterprise though, and saying, which was only two shows before this, and when it got to the end, and I thought, oh my God, Next Generation has finally gotten to the movie's level, as far not you know budget, but intensity, and at least doing something near movie on a TV budget. But the intensity and the oomph of it, I mean, when I found out later on that it was they all thought it was going to be a horrible show because of the way it was, you know, bass awkwardly written and thrown together. Not the concept, but the way it just had to be actually churned out. And then you start seeing these shows pile up and you're just going, oh my God, it's finally happening. This show is finally, I mean, that's the biggest thing about the third season. Not to put Michael on a pedestal, but it took, because Maury Hurley was working from Gene's thing, which was still really based on the original series idea, which was these have to be standalones. They're going to be syndicated. We can't have recurring lines. You know, that's all kind of been blown out of the water now, unless the pendulum is swinging back after Lost and everything else. You can have recurring lines, but having been really tightly serialized, they really, the whole reason there is a reset, not a reset button, but everything has to come back to the nice neat bow at the end is so people can watch them out of order. Because, you know, there are a lot of people, even on DS9's level, there are a lot of people now. And they may even be Trek fans, and they say, "Oh my God, I can't get into." I mean, DVDs and Netflix may help this, but for years people said, "I just cannot sit down and watch DS9 because I know there's like 9,000 characters and stories going, and I won't appreciate it."
Yeah,
yeah.
And DS9 scared people for years that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I keep trying to sit down and watch The Wire, and you know, I got a season and a half in, and I was just like, "I don't."
Oh, I thought you meant the DS9 episode.
Apparently. No. The TV show The Wire.
All that.
And I realized I hadn't been paying close enough attention to have any idea what was going on. I thought I could just watch the show and enjoy it. But no, with a truly serialized show, it does take a lot of effort on the viewer's part. You've got to sit down, pay attention, you know, take notes, you know, refer back to the whatever the Wire's version of Memory Alpha is.
Yeah, I found it.
And it's just like, you know, it takes the effort. It's useful, but I totally understand where they were coming from wanting to do serialized shows.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, who wants to work that hard just to watch a TV show?
Well, unless you're like...
But I think Larry has found the writer's guide, so I'm on the edge of my
Enterprise
seat.
Sticking in here. No, I'm almost... okay, here we go. Oh, look at the Chamber of Commerce, the Table of Contents. That was a strange... Yeah. Here we go. It's the February. February 4th, 87, which is the last one before they worked on the script. Captain Julian Picard and Riker with Y. And it's still Lieutenant Commander Macho Hernandez, the security chief.
Yeah.
And it's back to being Wesley Crusher. It went Wesley Leslie back and forth.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
I remember
and
that.
It was the 1701G for a while. Yeah. He's not. Now, they had the idea. In fact, it was Bob Justman's idea to have Worf have a Klingon Marine, quote-unquote, be there to show, oh, look, we're friends with them now. And that's here's how 80 years have gone by. Okay, Picard, Riker, number one, Data. Second in command of number one's away team, Data, rhymes with Data, is an android.
Boy, Pulaski would like to hear that. She would say, look, I'm justified after all these years.
That's funny how specific things like that get turned around. Here's the backstory for Data. If you want me to, it's like a paragraph here. Blah, 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 blah. When a Starfleet vessel arrived to search... Wait, what is this? Data's appearance is that of an Asian or Eurasian human in his mid-30s. Until the role is cast, Data can be defined as representing any racial group between Pacific Oceania to the Middle East. Whatever his final physiognomy, he is a result of highly advanced and never seen aliens who long ago manufactured him to serve as a repository of all the memories of a doomed Earth-Asian space colony. Unable to save those colonists from whatever exterminated them, the aliens of that world saved the memories of those colonists, resulting in Data being, in effect, the sum of that lost colony. In giving Data the ability to handle so many memories, the aliens equipped his android form with other capacities they apparently considered equally normal, at least for themselves. Thus, not only does Data have a memory capacity of phenomenal size as compared to humans, enabling him to serve the vessel and his landing team as something of a walking library, quote-unquote, his reading speed, manual dexterity, and strength are similarly above the human norm. When a Starfleet vessel arrived to search for the colonists, they found Data alone on the planet. This being Data's first contact with any sentient life form, he saw his own human form and that of his Starfleet rescuers as a beau ideal of existence. Despite his difference from other candidates, he passed the severest of Starfleet entry tests and has never received a mark against his performance. Starfleet's own regulations prevent the rejection of a candidate so long as it tests out to be a sentient life form. He is of the male gender, fully functional, possesses the dominant emotional traits of his parent colonists, and appears to be absolutely incapable of falsehood. Bang.
And?
Wow. I mean, the elements of that are used, but...
Yeah.
But certainly they decided to go a very different direction.
Nothing about Worf, and when they took the cast picture on June 1st on the cave set, Worf is not in the picture. He had been cast about the middle of May, but he was not considered a regular, so he wasn't in the. Not until after they shot the pilot and then sat back and looked at it, and they went, "Holy smoke, we got to get this guy on more often."
Wow. Huh.
That was a total sidebar, but I guess that leads into Sin's.
Well, no, but that's very interesting either way. And the other thing that I gathered from that is that apparently, according to Starfleet regulations, V'ger could become an officer because tested out ascension.
If you could get a butterfly net big enough to contain it, yeah, sure. Because they have to have the seats for the graduation ceremony somehow, you know. So.
Okay. Right. And where would you put the pips once he's an officer?
Very carefully. Oh, wait, that doesn't make any sense.
Oh, yeah, no, but that's interesting. And shows how the characters change. And
so when you hear, what the point is, when you hear writers give you that line, oh, if we have a good story, we'll be happy to, that they really mean that. They're not BSing, you know. Mm. It's like the whole Klingon forehead thing, from smooth to bumpy. It took a time until the whole staff was made up of fanboys. That helped. But, you know, that finally happened in Enterprise. And it had gotten so convoluted. And poor Ron and Renee, when they did the Trials and Tribulations script, they thought the joke was like making it halfway approaching being able to explain it. And all they did was complicate it.
They did, yeah. I really liked that Enterprise episode. I know that, you know, the fan base is split on it. But, yeah, I mean... For goodness sakes, if you can uncomplicate something, please, please do.
Well, if your uncomplication is still complicated, that still doesn't negate the fact that you uncomplicated something else. So, yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I always liked Worf's.
At least they didn't go to an RNA retrovirus or something where I.
Right.
Or T-cell.
I liked the Trials and Tribulations explanation that Worf gave. I liked the joke. I thought it was funny, and it was because I've never really cared about that whole thing in the first place. I've always just, well, you know, you have a budget and you have makeup, and I don't care if they have bumpy heads now and they didn't before personally, but that's me.
I'm sorry, Chris, your podcaster's license has been revoked.
I guess so.
That's just way, way, way too laid back. You could be laid back about it, but it's still, it's like, because, well, anyway, my thing, you know, it's like if they made the show to be, we're going to appeal to a higher audience, not Mensa members, but if we're not going to take our audience for granted, like you read the memos on the original series that are back in the making of Star Trek, the very first book. If they were trying to come up with their own on their own way and their limited staff and their limited budget, they were trying to do things like come up with Vulcan names and other ship names and keep it consistent. If they're trying to do that in the 60s, that's what they expected to build. So all then when you hear anybody later on go, oh my God, I wish the fans would just shut up about this stuff, it's like, no, that's part of the nature of the beast you made. And if it hadn't been there, most of us wouldn't be standing here talking about this right now.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, I completely understand.
I'll stop beating up on you now, Chris. I'm not really. That was more a generic thing not aimed at you, but yeah.
I completely understand the fan base as a whole debating that issue. If they had smooth-headed Klingons on The Next Generation in the first two seasons and then in the third season, suddenly they all have bumps on their heads, I would have said, wait a minute, what's going on here? But between the 60s and the late 80s, then... I don't know. I'm just have always been willing to let it go so I can just enjoy the
stories. The 60s in 1979.
Well, yes. I mean, it came up in the movie. But that's the thing, is that it came up in the movie. And it's easy for me to accept the explanation that we would have done something else with them in the past if we had the money. And now we do have the money, so now we're going to come up and make them look unique. That helps me to accept that, personally. Right.
But I mean, but Klingons are the only things they changed. The Vulcans didn't suddenly like get gigantic, you know, like wings or something. It's just Klingons.
Vulcans with wings.
That was the one we never got to do.
And they
right.
put the dumb bump on the thing on the Romulans' forehead.
They did change the Romulans.
Like one minor thing,
point.
Which is stupid too. But you know,
so the
and that kills it because they're supposed to be related to the Vulcans, like closely related. And I do hope Enterprise was never going to get around to explaining the bumps, because
what happened was that when
pretend that doesn't happen,
when those offshoots of the Vulcans, when they left Vulcan and they found Romulus, the ship crashed and they didn't have seatbelts, you know, like a Starfleet ship, and they smashed their heads into the bulkhead and it indented their skulls, and from that point forward, all Romulans have this indentation in their skull. That's you didn't see the Enterprise episode where they explained that.
No, I missed the car crash explanation.
It was going to be in the fifth season. At least that's what Manny Koto said.
This was another Manny episode to explain.
Yeah, this was from Manny Koto's Magic Bag of Hindsight.
Magic Bag of what?
Hindsight, yeah.
Magic Bag of Hindsight.
No, Manny Koto, in every single interview, he tells another episode that would have been in season 5 and would have been the most popular episode of Enterprise ever and would have made all the fans happy. If only they'd let him make season 5.
Well, I know Starbase 1 was the story he didn't get to. And what was the other one? And the Colonel Green show, which kind of became a little waving guy on the newsreel on Terra Prime and Demons. But
well, I heard that the Colonel Green show became quite popular there as Fox News and CNN were merging into the Federation News Network, and he had his own show. It came on right after Valeris and Friends.
he had a little picture of Colonel Oliver North hanging behind him on his set wall.
Exactly. And
it was his, you know, 200 years earlier patron saint, or 100 and something years earlier patron saint. Actually, no, he would have been like 50, 40
Friends.
Years.
Yeah, it's a good show.
Huh?
Valeris and Friends, that's a good show on Fox. Yeah. It's got Valeris, Savick, and Whoopi Goldberg. Yeah.
And Whoopi just goes on and on.
And they all hang out at the Section 31 Club.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, we should probably be wrapping up our discussion because we're way over an hour at this point. So why don't we wrap up with just some
final
thoughts?
Why do you have
thoughts?
Me on, Chris? I'm sorry.
Anything?
I'm sorry.
No, we love to hear all this stuff, Larry. But any final thoughts? Points or thoughts that you have about Sins of the Father or related stories that we haven't brought up yet?
Well, it's on Memory Alpha, but you should notice if now that you've got Blu-ray and you can read all those beloved Okudagram graphics closer, little bit was that the Intrepid's captain was Captain Drew Dayan, who was the guy with the spec script that they gave a story credit to on this. So, you know,
that's
it goes back that
that's
far.
A cool little nod.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Other than that, it's all been said, so
It has all been said at this point. We're an hour and 10 minutes in. But this is a really fantastic episode. I'm sure most people listening to this actually have gone back and watched Sins of the Father because it's on the Blu-ray now. But I'm like really excited to keep going in the show and in sequence continue to see what they do with the Klingons.
That would be cool. See, that would be a marketing thing that home video or home entertainment ought to do. The Klingon saga, you know.
Oh, they should,
and
definitely.
Just pull those out and do them. Yeah, like instead of the Q shows or the Seven of Nine shows.
Yeah, well, they've done a fan collective of Klingon episodes where the fans voted for the episodes. But yeah, doing a box that like actually followed the saga of the Duras family could be...
Oh, and I meant to say that, you know, Tony Todd became famous for the Candyman horror movies, but this was before that. The biggest thing he had done to date was be in Platoon, one of the heroic soldiers that died. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that.
And then Tony Todd goes on to play the elder Jake Sisko in The Visitor on Deep Space Nine.
Oh, if you want to go back to Star Trek, yeah.
Which is one of the great, yeah. Yeah, Star Trek, that show. For some reason, and we bring that up from time to time.
And he was a Hirogen Alpha on a few screens. In Voyager, and then he ran the CIA on Chuck, among other things, until he got killed.
Well, now you spoiled it. Thanks, Larry. I was watching Chuck, and now I'm.
Oh, I thought anyone in the world that was going to watch Chuck had seen it. Well, we mentioned Charles Cooper also playing Kim Peck here, and I won't say what happens to him again. We won't do spoilers. But he had been Cord in Star Trek V. They cat him back because they had that huge honking cape. And they wanted some symbol of office for the chancellor. And it's like, okay, here's this thing. Oh, it weighs a ton. Well, who was the guy that was in it before? Okay, let's get him back. I mean, it was like the kid. Because Bob O'Reilly talks about when he loved being Gowron and being chancellor, but he hated having to wear the cape because it weighed like 5 tons. And so they came up with, when he would have to be like on the chair, especially for House of Quark. It was like, if you watch House of Quark, it's like on the back of his chair. it's not like having to get up and sit down in it because it weighed a ton. So there you go. The killer chancellor cape. I saw the Klingon throne is on the current Klingon. Well, it won't be current by the time this is out maybe, but there's a Star Trek auction at Prop Works, and the Klingon throne is up for auction.
I wonder what that's going to go for. I always wanted, for Prop Works, I wanted the, I believe they were doing the Battlestar auction, and they had like Adama's table.
Are they the lucky ones?
And I just want to build a whole room around Adama's, like, the table he used, because it's really nice wooden thing. Anyway, but the Klingon chair, you know, have that on one side, and then Adama's table on the other side.
And,
right.
You know, invite
just,
girls.
Just remember,
it would be
Greg,
a couple
that,
of pieces of furniture.
Just remember, Greg, that if you do buy that, it is not delivered by Grace Park. So just, I know what you're thinking. All right. Well, I think I've pretty much said all the things that I think about Sins of the Baltar here. And
I think this is the time we need to say Mev Yap.
That's right. But it's a great episode.
Because Mev Yap is Klingonese for that is enough in this episode. Oh, we have to say one more thing. This is the first time, talk about Klingon first, this is the first time that today is a good day to die is uttered.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, see, there you go.
Yeah, that's true.
Wow.
Huh. I didn't really think about that one, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like Worf's favorite thing to say. He says it in pretty much every episode after
it's the favorite thing for Worf's fans to say.
That's true.
Well, are you sure?
That is
because
probably where I've heard
it more. There's that scene.
No,
where...
he said they repeat it a lot, but I'm just, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, there's that scene where he's down in engineering and Geordi needs him to help cross some wires in the control panel, and he takes the panel off and he looks at Geordi and he says, "Today is a good day to die."
Yeah.
And luckily, it didn't short out like it did for Trip on Enterprise, but.
Right. Well, all he had to do was cross circuit to B, which always worked for Spock and Scotty. But, there was also that scene when they were down in the replicator craft room and he was working with Crusher and Troy and they were coloring fabrics And they were trying to, it's when Troy and Worf were dating in the seventh season. Do you remember this? And they were trying to get him to come in, and they were going to do the alien costumes for the planet they had to beam down to. Instead of using the replicator, they were going to do them by hand, and they had to color the fabric they had on stock. And Worf was protesting and protesting. It was a really cute scene, and Troy finally looked at him and said, "Oh, come on, Worf, today is a good day to die." You saw that coming a mile away. It was okay. It's a Shaggy Klingon. It's a Shaggy Targ story. I'm sorry. Okay.
Right. Well, on that note, we will wrap up our discussion.
Thank God.
Here. So Larry, thanks for joining us. And is there anything that you want to plug here?
Everything.
Little
bits
coming up. I think.
Come over to Trekland. If I ever finally get my ass in gear, I would get my Ron Moore interview up. That's about 3 or 4 parts. I need to do that. A video. And we're still doing the Trek tour, which I hear is maybe mentioned on this same podcast this week, and at Geek Nation Tours, and LarryNemichek.com, and I'm gonna see Greg next weekend at Emerald City, in Seattle, and then I'm gonna be at a little convention called it's called SciFiCon in Lake Charles, Louisiana, about an hour east of Houston, in April. And then we hit SoonerCon in Oklahoma City and all the big summer cons like Comic-Con and Vegas and all that stuff. So come see me.
A busy guy. All right. So I guess to keep up with all those dates, the Trekland blog is the best place to just go.
Trekland blog and my site at LarryNemichek.com.
Wow. All right. We'll have links to those in the show notes as always. Okay. Well, good discussion, guys. And thanks again, Larry, for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. As long as you know, if you've got more than an hour's worth of tape, on your recorder.
right. It's a good thing we're going digital these days, right?
Oh, wow. That's so cool that you've done that. Yeah, okay.
Sons of the Baltar.
After episode 15, we went digital. Okay.
and down-resing the video for all your compositing.
Right.
Because who would ever want to Blu-ray this in the future?
Well, definitely great to have Larry back on the show. As we were saying on the other side of the room, Larry always just has mounds and mounds of knowledge that he can pull from. So it's great just having him on the show just to talk about just, a random episode of TNG.
Yeah, it is very interesting for us as well, because there are so many of these tidbits that For those who don't know, Larry has these massive files and books and tapes and all kinds of information that he's collected over the years from being around the set. And there's so much stuff that's not in his book and even not anywhere around on the internet that I've seen. So always interesting points that come up talking to Larry, and love having him on with us.
You might think if you've read Memory Alpha, you've read it all. But really, Larry's like Memory Alpha Plus.
Right.
That's why it's just great.
It's like having a Latinum subscription to Memory Alpha, right?
Right.
All right, Greg. Well, there was one thing I didn't bring up during the discussion that I just wanted to mention that always catches my eye. And tell me if you agree with me on this. In Sins of the Father, at the end, when Worf and Picard, well, first, all the Klingons, they turn their backs on Worf to show that he's no longer a Klingon. Mm-hmm. He's an outcast in his society. They've turned their backs on him. When he and Picard leave the chamber hall, when they walk out, don't you always want those 3 or 4 Klingons that are facing the back door to turn around after they pass through? Because I feel like they're staring at him all the way out the door.
Right. You almost expect them to start like waving. See you, Worf.
They're whispering like, "I've got your back. Don't worry."
Right.
Don't worry.
Don't worry.
We still love you, Worf. I just always thought it would have been nice if they quickly spun around as they pass through.
Well, what they should have had was like the bottom of the chamber like falls down, sort of like in the Star Wars, the prequels, where they that little podium at the middle of the Senate can sort of drop down to the lower chamber.
That would have been nice.
I guess that wasn't quite.
So what do you think? Everyone turns their backs on him, and then Ka'impek slams his hand into a button, and then the whole chamber floor just falls out, and Picard and Worf just go crashing down. Yeah. And there's like some kind of vacuum tube, and it spits them back out on the street outside. in front of the hall.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Awesome. All right. Well, Greg, why don't we tell everyone where they can find us if they want to share their thoughts on what we talked about. We do encourage everyone to contact us. Send us your emails. Hit us up on Twitter, Facebook. Let us know what you think. You can go to our website, trek.fm/contact, and send us a text message through there. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Google Plus at hyperchannel/trekfmg+ and on Twitter at username trekfm. And Greg, everyone can find you on Twitter as well.
That's right. You can find me there at Greg Harbin. That's GREGHARB as in boy, IN. Where you can find me mainly talking about how I can't stop spending money. I now have a new digital camera that I'm very proud of. So also be looking for my new, hopefully nice pictures of Seattle that will be coming out soon. And I'll be taking about a bazillion pictures this weekend. When you listen to this, you still have time to go buy tickets to the Emerald City Comic Con, which is in Seattle from March 30th to April 1st. That's Friday through Sunday. I'll be there. Larry Nemechek is there. You know, if that's not enough, Katie Sackhoff will be there. You know, if that's not enough, Will Wheaton will be there. So plenty of things to get you to come out to Emerald City Comic Con. If you're going to be there, send me an at reply or send Trek FM an at reply. And we'd love to see you there.
And you better do it quick. You do still have time when you hear this to follow Greg on Twitter. But do it quickly before Sci-Fi cancels his Twitter account.
We're not talking about it, guys. The thing. I actually no, we did. We mentioned in the
feature. I don't think we mentioned
we?
It by name. I'm not we didn't saying say it's I'm, name though.
Right. I didn't say its name. I didn't say I'm excited. Nothing. Dead silence, guys. Don't worry.
And since the father can't be canceled because it was shot 22 years ago, so we're safe on that.
Right.
All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is cbrianjones. That's Brian with a Y. And if you head over to Trek FM, to our website, you can play games. We have crosswords, word puzzles, lots of feature articles. We have other shows like Matter Stream. And we also have Trek Trivia if you want to test your Trek IQ. And that's at trek.fm/trektrivia. And you can follow username Trek Trivia on Twitter for live quizzes a few times each week. Okay, Greg, well, I'm going to head on out. I'm kind of hungry. I'm going to go have me some of that replicated burned bird meat that Kern loves so much.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick Picard's carving knife in it because the ready room is done.